Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use jobs. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode 18?
18, the Carpcast is old enough to drink.
Wow, yeah, legal, we're of legal age. So how you been doing?
I've been blanking like a good un, but I look good doing it. That's all I can say.
Are your rods level?
Oh no, you didn't see the rod from my Facebook, I purposely put a shot and they're just all over the place.
One with the four rods.
That's the one. I have angered the carp gods by my non-conformism.
Are you allowed to use four rods?
Does it matter? Yes, I am. Yeah, it's the fifth and sixth that are out of shot.
The snides in the reeds.
Yeah, and if Martin the Bailiff's listening, I'm only joking.
Every angler has a snide. We haven't done anything on snide rods, actually, have we? One for a later. I've got a few snide rod stories.
Yeah, I think we all have. You've got more snide rod stories than normal, I think.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
I think Nash missed a trick. The scopes should have been called the snides.
Yeah, good shout. Oh, just to correct something I've been shouted at for last week. I was going on about how much I liked my alarms, the S3s, as I was calling them, they're R3s. It was also pointed out on Facebook that the new Nevilles also have a similar thing to the Nashi ones, you know, the movement sensor, where it works on speed as well as just distance pulled. The RS1s were the first ones to ever do that, which is probably the best feature of them. It's a really useful feature. When they beep, something's happening, as opposed to just your line tightening or whatever. Obviously, the newer version of them, which I think are fantastic, are the R3s. Remote sounder box. I like everything about them. I like the look and everything. But yeah, it was pointed out that they are now not the only ones. It appears that Nevil have... copied maybe that feature.
Well, I can't blame him. It's a good feature, and well, we know Nevs are a good alarm. They've been around forever, stood the test of time.
Yeah, certainly. And Nashi used to distribute Nevs for a while. There was a Nashi version of the yeah. Nevilles.
They were stainless ones, weren't they?
That's right. Yeah, they were like a green colour or something. They weren't.
No, they were silver stainless, and every now and then you see them pop up on eBay and they do fetch a few quid.
Yeah, they're decent alarms. I mean, I've never really liked Nevilles personally. Just the fact that they are so basic, the tone on them is quite a long tone as well. You know, they basically, there's no subtleties in the indication. Like it's screaming or it's just doing a long beep. Like I like to be able to shut my eyes and picture what the bobbin's doing by what the alarm's telling me. So, you know, if you get like a five beeps up and four beeps down, you can picture like if it's chucking it down with rain and you're in your bivvy and you've kind of not ventured out, it's a liner. Like five beeps up, four beeps down, it's quite a common thing to happen when you're getting a liner. I can picture where the bobbin is, I can picture where it's sat. Like if you get that on like the, I'm not so much sure about the new Nevilles, but certainly, you know, your classic Neville, like five beats up, four beats down is just nine kind of really long beeps. It sounds like a screamer. You're getting wet to go and check, you know.
Yeah, I've got to be honest, I do like the different drop back tone available on some alarms. My little foxes have got it.
I think it's fairly essential to know when the bobbin's going back as to when it's going forward without looking at it. It's tricky to do on a lot of alarms because I know Fox patented it pretty heavily. The top of the RAM, and if you want to spend 180 quid an alarm, the top of the range Fox ones are amazing. I do have a set of them as well. And they are pretty good for a, they are very good, but it's quite a bit of money if you want to look extremely posy, get them on the bank. But, you know, going in at the £100-ish kind of price range. We were on about the Delkims are kind of priced in the middle of that, and some people like how a Delkin works. I prefer the roller buzzer, and I think I'd take the R3s all day. But when you have as many snide rods as me, you need two sets of alarms. one to leave in situ on the Sneaky Lakes, and one to take for my above ground fishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey. So yeah, I have two sets. I've got the Foxes and I've got the R3s, which I like. But yeah, just correcting on last week because I called them S3s and they are not.
Yeah. Another correction. We mentioned what we've seen on the net about the price at A1 pits going up, and people were moaning and throwing their toys out the pram. And I've had a message saying it isn't.
It's not going up.
No, sticking at £15 for 24 hours.
Well, they might see me again then, because I think that's extremely fair pricing for that lake, and it's worth me travelling for three nights fishing for £45. So I'm pleased to hear that. I mean, I don't know if they backtracked because everybody kicked off, or whether it was just a rumour that was unfounded. I don't know.
I don't know. It's unfounded rumour as far as I know.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Oh, yes. With a hint of sarcasm. You know what? Can you actually hear me all right here?
Yeah, can hear you fine.
I've just noticed I'm on the Mac mic. I've not even plugged my mic in.
Yeah, sounds really clear.
Oh, I'll carry on then.
Carry on. So we're going to go weekly. You'll be pleased to know all the people that have been asking us to. There is some money coming in. We have our fantastic sponsors DNA, and other ones have come on board now, which is great. It means we can move the show weekly, and we can kind of get paid for doing it, because it does drain quite a bit of time. It's certainly a full day. You know, it's a day's work to do it, and then a few hours uploading on a Friday. So you'll be pleased. People really seem to like it still, which is fantastic. We get messages every day. Our little controversy over the last couple of weeks, which we'll touch on in a bit, but the what we're going to call it, Fishgate. I think Mark Holmes and Daryl's situation kind of needlessly exploded.
Needlessly being the key word there.
Yep, we will touch on this in a little bit, but it basically it made our download stats go crazy. I think last month we had 14,000 and something downloads.
Yeah, I think we've passed that one already this month with one episode.
Yeah, we've had one episode out this month, and we've hit those same figures already, and that's all because of a lot of people discovering it through all the stuff on the net that was being discussed, both sort of negative and positive. It's kind of been directed more people to the Carpcast anyway, which is a nice silver lining. We don't like people falling out or getting a bit salty online, which we will touch on, as I say. But
yeah, we've got that on the net. Also, we'd add to going weekly, we can tell you about a few guests we've been speaking to coming up in the future. So yeah. I've been talking to, had a really good phone call with Chris Ball, carp historian.
Yeah, I can't wait to get Chris on. He's a mine of information and loves telling stories.
He certainly is. And also, I'm popping down to actually fish for 24 hours with Ian Russell.
That's good. Yeah, it's another
chat
guest
to him on the bank.
Another guest that's been requested. We know John Max there in the pipeline. We managed to get somebody we've been hunting down for ages, Simon Scott, who is on later in this show. You'll be pleased to know. In fact, it was such a good interview. It lasted quite a long time. So we're gonna split it into two. So you'll get part one this week and part two next week, next Friday.
We're also going to try and do a Ting Tong take two. Out at Eurowack, because we deleted the first one.
Say that fast.
Ting Tong take two.
Yeah, Ting Tong take two. Yep, we recorded him on Eurowack originally and deleted it accidentally. And he is back on Eurowack maybe next week or the week after. So we're going to do our On the Bank feature, and we will be getting tales of hippos, no doubt. It'll be his second trip, so he knows what he's in for, and hopefully he'll catch a few more than he caught last time.
Yep. And Adam Penning has set the standard by catching one live for the Carpcast microphone.
Yep, so let's see if he can catch he could potentially catch a world record while live. While live, so yeah, we look forward to that. We've got a whole list of cracking guests. Frank Warwick's on the list. There's we made a list last week, didn't we? And there's loads going to be up between now and Christmas.
Terry Edmonds is one.
Yep, and I think we'll do our first Carpcast social as well. I'll probably looking at April next year for the first one. I think we plan to do three, maybe four next year, where you can come and fish with us. There'll be some coaching tuition available from people other than us, because we can only tell you how to blank currently. But yeah, probably do it on Cromwell, the first one. So that I reckon there'll be 12, maybe 14 places available on that lake. And we are looking for other suitable lakes around the country. Maybe one in the Midlands, one in the South, possibly one in the Oxford Lakes, maybe Willow on the Lynch Complex or somewhere similar to do a private lake hire. And have a Carpcast social regularly throughout the year. You can come and fish with us. We'll show you how to blank. It's something... people have already been expressing an interest in. I had a message today, funnily enough, from a chap that said, yeah, he'd be really keen to come. We'll provide a few beers and some sort of hog roast or barbecue or something similar. I'm looking forward to them. But let's move on to our sponsors. Whole reason why this is going weekly and keeping going is because some people out there have been supporting us, and DNA Baits we're proud to announce as a partner with the Carpcast. You can get their stuff at dnabaits.com. And there's a 5% discount on anything you purchase from them if you use the code CARPCAST5 when you check out. There'll be a box where you can enter a discount code. It's CARPCAST5, and you can get there's great deals on there anyway, but you get an extra 5% off. They're running the Evo Cured Hook Baits offer, as Mark Holmes kind of made them popular, the cured hook baits with the GLM powder. It's a special Carpcast offer that's in the offers page on their website. It's £20 delivered for the hook bait kit and the GLM powder, and it's been really popular apparently, so they've left it on. That's still there, and it's a special Carpcast offer. It does support us, but they do some cracking stuff on there. All the fluoro pop-ups and candy sticks look really interesting, the wafters, and they're doing a special deal on 20 kilos at the minute as well, post free. I think it's £120 delivered to your door in any one of their flavours, like the SLK or the Nutters, the Ocean X, like any of their boilies. It's 20 key delivered post free to your door for £120, and you can get 5% off that as well by using the CARPCAST5 discount code when you check out. So check out dnabaits.com. Please support them, they're supporting us, and it's decent gear too.
Yeah, it is. You know what, that sounds tempting to me, because I did a little stock check in my freezer before this session, and I'm fishing a lake full of bream and I've run out of 20 mils. Ah. I can see some punishment in the future if I don't get something sorted.
Well, get on there, use the Carpcast code CARPCAST5, get 5% off, and they're going to send us a few hook baits and stuff as well. You can be our field tester, the Carpcast field tester. You're the only one catching fish this year, so you can use a few of the pop-ups and stuff. But yeah, it looks really good. A few of our pals, in fact, we've got an on the bank later. Our pal Roger Bacon is on Sourcey in France, and he's catching, and he uses DNA, and he loves the DNA. He's been using it for a year now. He's had some great results, but we'll be hearing from him in a little while.
Right, we've got Amazon. This is the one it's more of an affiliate link than a sponsor. But what I've done is something slightly different. I've seen a great deal on Amazon, so the link actually goes direct to there at the minute. It's a Scope Bivvy with ground sheet and overwrap, all for $249.99.
I saw that, yeah, it's pretty cheap, that is, as well. We'll put the link on our page. If you're after a Scope Bivvy, just click that link and get it from Amazon. It's super cheap, and that'll give us a little kickback off that as well.
It will, and also, you don't have to buy that. If you go to Amazon, you can just click the link and go wherever you want. Because looking at the Amazon stuff, you know, when I look at, I'll get on the account, you know, I actually get a report what people bought. And my favourite one so far is some incredible, I think it's Marvel, Incredible Hulk Smash Fists. Yeah. I want a set of them myself. It'll sound like fun.
Yeah, did we make like 50p off that as well?
Oh, I think it was about 8, but I don't care. It was, I want some.
Fantastic. There's a new sponsor this week as well.
There is. I spoke to Mark from Hobo Armour, which is hoboarmour.com. It's a clothing company with some quite witty T-shirts. Look like, love it when they scream. Buzzers, obviously, nothing else. But they've got T-shirts, your hoodies, your zip-ups, you know, some quite good hats and beanies, and we all need a warm hat coming into winter. You know, and there's children's sizes, and well, I looked at the sizes, because I'm a bit of a lump. They do from extra small right through to 4XL. So whether you're a midget or a monster, there's something there for you. You know, no green, some camo. They also do, well, quite like the look at, Hobo Optics, polarised glasses as well.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the T-shirts with the spots and the alarms on them. They do quite a lot of carpy stuff. HoboArmour.com.
Yep, and if you put the same code in as at the checkout, CarpCast5, there is 10% off your purchase.
Shouldn't that be CarpCast10?
It should, but I think it did the DNA one. We'll just stick to the same code.
Ah, so use CarpCast5 on HoboArmour.com if you're buying anything. I like the snapbacks on there as well. Those DPM snapbacks look pretty cool. Like camo-y fronts. And HoboArmour.com. Loads of stuff on there, and use the checkout code or the discount code when you check out, CarpCast5, and you can receive 10% off all their stuff. Once again, go and check their stuff out and help support the show wherever you can.
What we got next? Oh, this is the original Northern Angling Show.
Yeah, we were also sponsored by the Northern Angling Show. Northernanglingshow.co.uk. Looking fantastic this year. We've just signed a 7-year deal with the venue after this coming show. The coming show is on the 21st of February. Tickets are on sale at northernanglingshow.co.uk. There's a load of VIP packs as well where you can pay £40 and you get basically 50, 60 quid's worth of gear depending on which company it is, and you get a free ticket for the show. So go and check that out. There's all sorts of offers on there. CC Moore, Nash, Fox, MAP, Preston Innovations. There's all sorts. northernanglingshow.co.uk. Grab a VIP pack or just grab a ticket and it's going to be even busier than last year. I think ticket sales are 20% up on last year already, and we're still like 5.5 months away from the event. Floor space is almost sold out. I think there's a few small stands for any little companies that might be interested. But all the info you need, northernanglingshow.co.uk.
Yeah. When are you going to make some announcements? You know, who's speaking? Who the big?
Yeah, we've got a few exhibitors there. We've got a few booked in already. But the majority of them are people associated with companies. We've got the Big Fish Off Again series. Two will be out with Ali and Dean Macy. Series two will be out just before the show, literally the week before the show, I think it starts running. And they'll be doing a load of behind the scenes footage and stuff at the show.
Worth a look.
Definitely worth a look. There'll be a representative. Alan Blair will be doing something from Nash again. I think Holmes is going to be doing a bit. But yeah, we'll be releasing. I don't want to ruin it too much because we have official release dates for these sorts of stuff as part of the marketing strategy. So I don't want to blow all the good stuff up right now. But it's going to be amazing. I mean, the talks were amazing last year, and they shall be even better. It's absolutely packed out with everything. But all the info you need, northernanglingshow.co.uk. And while we're whoring ourselves out, a personal one for me. I made a couple of DVDs a few years ago called The Knowledge. The first one was on syndicate fishing in the UK. The second one was made in France. And people keep buying them. I don't know why. I haven't really pushed them for 3 or 4 years. But everybody seems to be liking them. The feedback we've been getting from people who have been purchasing them. Done a special offer. They're on eBay. You can just search eBay for The Knowledge Jamie Klosick or The Knowledge Carp Fishing. Or there's a link on our Facebook page. It's £10 for 2 DVDs. And everyone seems to think it's extremely good value. All the people that have watched them keep posting nice things underneath saying how they've enjoyed them. So you can just hear me rant for another 3-4 hours, or maybe even pick up something in there you hadn't thought of already. Some of the little edges and things that I used to do a few years ago and probably still do now, because carp fishing doesn't change that much, but yeah, you can buy them. They're on eBay. Just search the Knowledge Jamie Klosick and you should find them, or check out the link on our page.
It's on the net. It must be true.
The Carp Society show, it's been advertised. That's coming up very soon. Being involved in a show myself, I'd be careful what I say. I don't want to put down the competition at all, because we try and remain as independent as possible on this show. But I just wondered, with the sort of bad press that the Carp Society have had this year, you know, they've been investigated for serious fraud. They've been reported for serious fraud because some people, you know, previous committee members believe that things are untoward with the way they've removed the membership, essentially. We've spoke about this on which Carpcast was it?
10, I believe.
Yeah, so for those who haven't listened to 10 yet, the Carp Society basically have tried to run down the membership. There's about, I think there's 11 members now, 7 of which are on the committee. They've made it so you don't need to have a membership to fish Horseshoe Lake, which is very suspicious. You now just need a Horseshoe card instead of a membership to the Carp Society. And it's been alleged by a couple of people who've had documents in their possession and have evidence and facts of that Horseshoe, there was possibly a plan by some people, an alleged plan that they were going to sell the lake and presumably split the money between the members, members being the people that actually run the Carp Society and literally nobody else. I think the only other members are like wives and girlfriends of committee members and stuff. I don't think there are any actual independent genuine members, because there's no need. They put the price up to £90 and made it quite difficult to actually join. You can only join for a 2-week period in January. It seems like they don't really want any members. And why would they not want any members? Because say they do sell the assets. This is my opinion as to why. I mean, other people might have a different reason as to why they don't want any members, but it looks a little bit murky to me. So anyway, there's obviously been quite a lot of discussion about that. That they are, that the people in charge are possibly trying to line their own pockets. Now, they only own those assets. This is my issue. They own those assets because of people like me 20 years ago who pledged money for them to buy Horseshoe Lake. That's how it worked. They sold a load of 10-year tickets to raise the funds to buy the lake for the Carp Society members. It wasn't for the committee to get rich some point in the future when it gets sold for £1 million, £1.5 million or whatever the valuation would be, but it's certainly a significant amount of money. That was not the purpose of the Carp Society, to make, you know, a small group of individuals very wealthy. Now the only other business that the Carp Society have other than the lake is the Carp Society show, and I'm going to watch with interest. I mean, it's coming up soon. I'm going to watch with interest as to how well supported it is, because I mean, it's kind of endorsing, you know, if you had an issue with the Carp Society just being a business now, you know, without the best interests of carp fishing at heart, which kind of appears on the outside to be the case, rather than being a group that, you know, youngsters want to join and you know, be a part of a group with like-minded people. It doesn't seem to be about that anymore. It just seems to be about making money. And for me, supporting that show is kind of endorsing that. So there was an interesting debate. I know Julian chimed in saying he just goes to meet his friends and, you know, he does his talks, does some great interviews, as Julian does at these shows. You know, he's been involved with the Carp Society for a lot of years. So, you know, I don't blame him for that at all, but I'm really interested to see what other people's views on it, whether they'll just kind of ignore what the Carp Society are doing in the carp fishing industry at the minute and just go anyway.
I think they'll have a successful show, as they usually do, to be honest, because
it's been one of the best shows on the calendar for years. I mean, you know, that's why I'm choosing my words carefully. Yeah. It's always been a successful show.
Been a couple of times myself, and you know what? With politics and fishing, apathy runs rampant. people just want to go fishing, or they want to go show and chill with their mates.
Yeah, this is probably what I think will happen, is people will just go anyway. But I mean, I'm somebody that has ethics, morals, opinions, you know, and I'd kind of feel hypocritical having a bit of a problem with what the cat, you know, horseshoe was the lake that I fished as a kid. You know, I fished it from the age of like 14 to probably 17 as one of my main lakes. You know, I spent a lot of time there. It means a lot to me. You know, as a member of the Carp Society at the time, they made the pledges and stuff. I was a keen youngster who sent an application letter to the Carp Society because I wanted to join. I wanted to be part of a group. And it just seems like somebody's just trying to line their own pockets from people like me, my passion, you know, 25 years ago. It just feels a bit wrong. So I couldn't then go and, you know, pay a tenner to go to a show and line their pockets further. I couldn't do it, especially as the chairman doesn't even live in the UK anymore. If what you read is to be believed, he's got a beachside property and is kind of retired. Takes a 30k a year income from Horseshoe Lake. You know, this is I don't know, it doesn't ring nice with me. It doesn't sit well, I should say. So they won't be getting my support, but I'm interested to see how it goes. It will probably just have the same amount of visitors as it normally has, because like I say, people are apathetic. They go, oh yeah, I want to go and look at the latest range of products from various companies, then they're probably just going to go. But I mean, there are a number of other shows in the southeast over this winter period, so it's not like it's the only place you can go and have a social with some carpy pals.
No, and I think the people who could have made a difference to it if they were taking the high road is the companies. But they're there.
Yeah, I don't know. I've not actually checked to see what companies are going. But again, you know, the companies by definition are in there to make money, you know, and if they're going to sell a lot of gear at a show, it's the customers, it's the footfall that's will be the key to it. The companies won't want to be there if people don't go. So, but we'll see, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I might go down on the Sunday.
You'll be banned from the Carpcast for a week.
You don't want a lift.
Yeah, come pick it up. So yeah, it was on the net anyway. I saw it being advertised quite a bit, and you know, if they want to get salty with me for bringing this up, we've kind of just given them an advert, the old any publicity is good publicity type theory. You know, we've just made people aware that they've got a show coming up. If you want to go, by all means go. I'm not telling you not to go. I'm just saying I wouldn't go because of, you know, Horseshoe meant something to me back in the day. And if the alleged rumours are true, and I mean, people have come out publicly and said this. I've spoke to people that have documents in their possession and have forwarded these to the Serious Fraud Office. It is being investigated, as far as I'm aware. If anything untoward has gone down, you know, heads will roll. I'm pretty sure of it. But that remains to be seen. I'm not privy to the inside information, but it was on the net, so we mentioned it. Something else that's been on the net, we touched on it earlier.
It's on the net, it must be true.
Mark Holmes, the big Fishgate debate. Mark's a popular guy on the show, and made a statement that he thinks large male carp predominantly feed off fish. We do ask Simon Scott this. I won't give you a spoiler now. We do ask Simon Scott that exact question. He gives an interesting answer, as he does give an interesting answer to everything I asked him about the habits of carp. So it's a fantastic interview. But Daryl listened. After Daryl came on the show, he then listened to Holmes's Carpcast. I'm glad that Daryl started going through older episodes of us after probably not knowing much about it. He heard Mark say that, probably took it a little out of context, took it maybe as Mark saying that big male carp only or don't eat boilies and only eat fish. And obviously somebody like Daryl's caught loads of large male carp, so he's obviously going to say, hang on a minute, that's not correct. He made a post late one evening after a couple of beers on Facebook and went to bed. While he went to bed, World War III started. I got onto it about midnight. I was actually playing poker in Nottingham, and I noticed somebody tagged me in it. In the threads, and basically Daryl had made a post saying, I've never heard so much rubbish in my life, male carp only eat, don't eat boilies, never heard so much rubbish in my life. Now there's nothing personal, there's nothing, you know, he's not berating anybody there, he's just saying that he finds that ridiculous, which is fine, it's a personal opinion of Daryl's. Anyway, what happened then needn't have happened. Basically there was 100+ replies over the next 2 or 3 hours. It kept me up all night, actually, because my phone kept going, people kept messaging me, have you seen this, screenshots, all sorts. Basically, it was
your popcorn.
Yeah, it turned into a bit of a war. You had pro Holmesy people and pro Daryl people going at it against each other. Now bear in mind, Daryl said nothing personal, he's made, said that he thought was ridiculous and went to bed. He woke up at 7 a.m, saw that World War 3 had started, deleted it immediately, and made an apology post saying, I did not mean to start a war, this has got out of hand, this is ridiculous. And that's the only thing he's done. He's held his head up high, as far as I'm concerned, and he's never said a word since. He's got on with his life. In the meantime, this same night, Holmesy copied Daryl's post and then posted it on his Facebook page, and which also started mainly pro Holmesy people slating Daryl, saying some really horrible personal things, as did some people on Daryl's post about Mark. I have to say that the nastiness, the saltiness, the poisonous comments were probably 50-50 on both parties. Holmesy's, if you want to call them followers, Holmesy's followers said just as many nasty things about Daryl as in Daryl's thread about Holmesy. It's 50-50 there. The only thing I will say is Daryl kind of quashed it and never resurfaced it. Holmesy, and I know he'll listen to this, not having a personal pop, but my opinion is he's kind of not let it lie. You know, he's made various posts since, kind of fueling it. I don't really think there was any need for that, personally. I know Mark does feel like he's been on the brunt, undeservedly been on the brunt of some people's putting down, you know, like, you know, he's had an extremely successful year, he's been catching a lot of big fish for a lot of years, and maybe kind of feels that people want to take the opportunity to have a pop at him whenever they can. So maybe this goes a little bit deeper than just this one situation. So I totally understand him wanting to defend himself and basically saying, you know, bugger off you lot, nobody's going to stop me, and so he should. You know, the guy's extremely successful doing what he wants to do, and nobody has a right to put anyone down for anything. But, you know, if somebody's going to hold their head high and walk away from this, I think Daryl's done that and tried to quash this as quickly and as honestly and openly as he can. Made an apology, and I don't know. It appears to me, in my personal opinion, Mark's likes being the victim.
I've got to agree with you a bit on there, to be honest. I think it's, you know, after Daryl quashed it, should have just let it lie, carry on, it's fishing, it's not life and death.
That should have been it, yeah. I mean, you know, Mark did say that his kids saw, his 13-year-old kid, he put in one of the posts, had seen, came in the room crying because they'd seen people saying nasty stuff about their dad. I mean, I totally understand that, but, you know, there's a lot of nasty stuff on Facebook a 13-year-old kid can see. A lot worse than, you know, fishermen having an argument with each other, a hell of a lot worse.
Definitely a hell of a lot worse. I had a going beheading one appear on my one today. I didn't really want to be seeing that.
This is my point. I mean, there's no need to, I don't want to see there's any real need to bring your kids into it. It's a horrible situation that nobody wanted to add. You know, the people in Holmesy's thread were just as nasty to Daryl as vice versa, and nobody's got the right to sit there being personal about people. You know, I'm not happy with anyone saying personal stuff about Holmesy or Daryl. Like, neither sits well with me. You know, they're both decent guys, in my opinion. And it just shows the nastiness of the internet. You know, this feature is called On the Net, it must be true, in a bit of a tongue-in-cheek fashion, because keyboard warriors like saying horrible shit from behind a keyboard, you know, stuff people would never dare say in real life.
Yeah, let's be honest, the internet and the anonymity it gives you, it brings out the worst in a lot of people.
It does, it really does, you know, I've been on it as well, you know, years ago, pre-Facebook, I took a lot of grief for some of the fish that I caught in Shropshire many years ago, the banana common and stuff, on all the fishing forums. So I've been there, I know how Mark feels. I've woke up with people making personal attacks on me, I've woke up and had to read that about myself, so, you know, it's horrible, and people react to it in different ways. The way Holmesy's reacted to it is to keep making posts about it. It was just, that's the way the internet works, it just fuels it, it just keeps going, and that's the bit I think there's no need, just let it lie. I think Daryl's done the honourable thing, he never said anything personal about Mark at all. He basically made the one post saying I find this ridiculous and went to bed, woke up, saw World War 3 had happened, deleted it, and that's not another word's come out of his mouth since.
A question, you know, back when you were getting, you know, all your abuse for the banana common and that, how did you handle it?
I wanted to fight them all. I actually drove to Shropshire looking for one guy to fill him in, because he would not let it lie.
It's good you've grown up and matured.
Yeah, I found out where he worked, in a bike shop, and I actually went there one day, and he wasn't working, fortunately for me, probably, and him.
I can't tell, because I had a similar sort of thing on an incident in St. Ives a few years back, where a fella slated me off, calling me, well, basically twisted a story of what really happened. So a couple of years later, it's when we were meeting up for a Woolpack work party. I knew he was actually fishing St. Ives, so I took a drive down and walked into his swim.
It's sometimes, I'm not sure it is the best way. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad the mood I was in that particular day, I'm glad I didn't find the person I was looking for.
Nothing ever happened. Like, he's like, oh, I'm joking, mate, and backpedaled as quick as anyone ever could.
This is the annoying thing about the internet, is people say stuff they would never dare say, you know, they'd be nice as pie to your face. But I mean, and I know Daryl was also not being vindictive. He's not a vindictive person, he's a decent guy. And I know he wasn't when he made that post, he just found it incredulous what Mark said. Now, we all have findings that other people might find incredulous. You know, Mark's an experienced angler, as is Daryl. Daryl's found stuff out for himself, and Mark's found stuff out for himself. Just because one person's found something that the other guy can't comprehend, or may not, you know, in a vacuum, in an instant thing, doesn't mean that anyone's right or wrong, and it doesn't mean that he can't say, wow, that's crazy, I've never heard anything like that before, which is pretty much what Daryl said, you know. Now, Daryl did say something similar to me. I mean, when we were fishing after St. Ives and stuff, long time ago, 12 years ago, I remember me, Daryl and John Matt were all pretty close at the time, you know, speaking every day about fishing and stuff on the phone, and, you know, meeting up on lakes and whatever. And I remember Daryl reading an article of John Mack's, where John Mack said he was smelling the weed for fish. And Daryl rang me up and he went, have you read that? He said basically the same things what he said about Mark. I've never read anything so rubbish in my life. Has John run out of things to write or something? You know. And this is his mate. He's not rubbing anybody down. He's making, you know, he'd read something that he thought was ridiculous. And my first thing I said to him is, don't you do that. I'm like, every time I pull a bit of weed and I smell it, because when carp, you know, carp are very slimy, as are other fish, and you can't mistake the smell of a carp. And if there's a group of fish in a weed bed or swimming past that weed bed or through it regular, they're going to rub the slime off onto the weed, and you can smell it. I always smell the weed, and I don't think it's an uncommon thing now, but maybe 12, 13 years ago, Daryl obviously hadn't heard of it before, and I remember him saying exactly the same to me. Is he mad? What on earth's he on about? That's rubbish. He's just trying to find something to write about. I'm like, I do it, and a few people I know do it. So I know when I saw that post, I saw exactly what Daryl wrote. It was nothing personal. It was just something that he'd found different, as you know. And the fact that he's caught lots of male carp on boilies, I mean, he maybe took the statement the wrong way. I mean, Mark did say that he thinks large male fish predominantly eat fish, which is contentious. Of course it is. Mark's a contentious person. He gives his opinions and, you know, you take it on board or you don't. Like, it's as simple as that. But there is no need for World War III to start and people to start being very personal about each other's. And if you're one of them people listening to this that said something really horrible about Mark or Daryl, then you need to have a word with yourself, you know, or please delete me from Facebook and stay away, because you're poisonous. And if you're one of them people that want to put people down, you know, to make, possibly say stuff about Mark, say something that would make his children sad, or something that would hurt anybody, if you're somebody that regularly posts that sort of stuff, then you're a shithead. And that's it. That's what I've got to say on it.
A shithead. I like that.
Poison dwarf.
Yeah. Well, then it's to take it off. It's cyberbullying.
It is. It is, and I won't stand for it. You know, I've been on the receiving end of it. I mean, to other, you know, not fueling the fire is the answer to it, and that's my only issue with how Mark's handled it, is he's kept fueling the fire. Yeah. You know, there's only so many times your followers are going to like you, whatever you do, right? So every time you make a post, you're going to get a load of your followers going, "Don't worry, Mark, you're the best. You know, keep doing what you're doing. Show them with the fish results, blah blah." You know, you're going to get all that. You don't need to keep making posts just to be told that again and again and again and again. You have to draw a line in the sand somewhere at playing the victim, I think. But I do totally understand why Mark was upset, because I've been on the end of it, and as I said, don't be a shithead. Don't be one of them people that makes them horrible remarks on the internet. Just makes you look a wanker. That's my piece.
We're going to have to put the explicit moniker next to this podcast. You're getting quite passionate.
I feel passionate about it, yeah. You shouldn't be doing stuff like that.
Well, let's take this situation. If it wasn't on the internet, if it was at the real world, say Mark and Dowler on a stage being interviewed, having a debate, it'd all be friendly and everyone would think it'd be great and there wouldn't be any slating.
Well, we have a platform here. We have a platform on here where we can have as many people on a Skype call as possible. So, you know, if we have difference of opinions, we invite anybody on to come and tell each other your findings, and let's all learn something from it. So let's move on to more positive stuff. Yes. There is an extremely positive story on the net at the minute, and that's because we are world champions. Yes.
We won.
Sir Rob Hughes, as I'm sure they will be knighted at some point in the future. We've got Sir Rob on the line now to tell us about it. So hello to Rob Hughes, world champion manager. Congratulations, first of all. Absolutely fantastic result. You certainly achieved the goal of getting the whole of the UK angling community behind the lads out there. My Facebook feed was full of it on the day. People wanting to know results, people genuinely excited. And that was your plan from the start, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, firstly, I'll say thank you for having me on again. And secondly, wow, world champion, that's got a lovely ring to it, isn't it? I'm never going to get tired of hearing that. It's been an amazing experience. But yeah, I think when I took on the role of manager, there were a number of things that I wanted to do. Ultimately, it's attain success. That will be the litmus test. That will be the benchmark as to whether or not we have done what we needed to do. And there's no point entering any competition if you don't want to win it. And if you come back with silverware, ideally yellow or preferably gold silverware, then clearly you've done very well at it. And that had to be the ultimate aim. But there's a number of byproducts to being in an event like this, in that we see it with the football. You're on the world stage, literally. Now, hopefully your performance will be one that will put you down in history. But your attitude and your performance, irrespective of the result, will definitely make a mark. And that's one of the things that we wanted to do, because I think over the last few years, we've perhaps lost a little bit of dignity. I've seen it reported in the press, and it's a very good description, that England have actually been lowered in the eyes of some of the foreign nations, either as a result of results themselves or alternatively as a result of just how we're perceived. And that was one of the massive things that I wanted to change, and I think we've managed to do that. The you know, again, the litmus test for that is how everybody recognises you at the end. And It's interesting. I've been to a lot of big events this year, and I've seen the presentation of a lot of big events, and some champions are worthy champions and really liked, and there's a massive round of applause, and others just get a ripple because whoever they are, they're either not conducting themselves very well or they've won in a way that the other competitors don't like it. And I will say with this one, the applause we had at the end was amazing. And even before the actual award ceremony itself, when we walked into the hall, we arrived a little bit late, not fashionably late, but the other guys were there before us. We were staying at a place that was a little bit further out of town. So everybody was in the hall, sat down, having a beer, all chilling out. There's half an hour or so before the event starts, but, you know, it was a packed room. And we've walked in, and the applause started at the back of the room as we're walking in, and it turned into a crescendo and a standing ovation. And this is literally just walking into the room.
You must have tears in your eyes there.
It was amazing. And that probably moved me more than when we were on the podium.
Yeah.
You know, it was an amazing baptism turning up at that, because, you know, make no mistake, it had been an emotional week. It had been a very tough week. And everybody was looking forward to the grand finale, which is when you get on the stage and hear the national anthem. And there was trepidation, there was nerves, you know, we were buzzing, but we were sort of, you know, not scared, but, you know what I mean, edgy at the same time, because it's a big occasion. And to walk into that sort of a welcome, it just tells you that you've done your job in every possible way.
You certainly did the job. I mean, first, I'm guessing we'd have taken a second or third with a going back to win it next time. I mean, where are you going to go from first? The pressure's on now. We can't ever accept a second or third.
Well, don't put too much pressure on me, please. I was talking to my captain, the lad we appointed captain, Mark Bartlett, afterwards, we were having a similar sort of conversation where, you know, where do you go from here? And what you do is you enter the tournament again with dignity. You fight as hard as you can do with the aim of winning and bringing back silverware. And I'll repeat again now what I said before we went out there to this one. Whatever the outcome, you can absolutely guarantee it will not be for the want of trying. We have a motto, and a lot of big sporting events require decent psychological motivation. You know, everybody that goes into this event, bear in mind there's 24 countries there, admittedly some are slightly more skilled than others, but 24 countries field their best anglers,
yep,
in this sort of fishing. So we're not just turning up for a little knock-up. There's 24 teams of three, so 72 of incredibly good anglers that the best put out there, and everybody's capable. So you need everything to fall into place. And I would say that of all the events that I've fished, bearing in mind this is the first time I've done one of these team events, of all the events that I've fished, this is probably the one where luck plays the least part. In that, if you've just got one pair to worry about, you might get a good swim on a draw and you've got it. Because if you are a good angler and you get the flyer, the chances are that it's going to be yours. If you get a duffer, then there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. You've had it. You've had it from the draw. And I've been in events before now where as soon as you put your hand in the draw bag and you pull a peg out, you know you're finished. When you've got three pairs, three sections, and everybody has points, and the way that they work the system, you draw for your placement in section A. Now, for the people that don't know how the event works, there's an A section, a B section, and a C section. And there's one pair from each country in each section. Now, when you draw your first number from A section, if you get one between 1 and 8, in B section, you will get one between 8 and 16. I'm doing my maths there. And then the last one, you will get an N. So you'll get a low number, a mid number, and a high number.
Yeah.
If your first draw is a high number, then your next two sections, you'll have a mid and a low.
Yeah.
So you're very well spread along sections that are to a degree regulated to be fairly even. So whilst there is always going to be the odd flyer, i.e. an end peg or a peninsula or a point, I'll take B section as a prime example. It was a split section. There were four end pegs and there were 2 points, plus there was a flyer with a load of sunken trees in it.
Yeah.
So you've actually got 6-7 absolute flying swims within a 12 peg section. So you know the luck element of having a real flyer or a real poor one is actually very low down, which suits us perfectly, because what it then does is it comes into angling skill.
So it works. The scoring works on like penalties, doesn't it? You need all three your teams in three sections to achieve, basically. Otherwise, you can't win it. If you have one team or one pair doing badly in one of the sections, I mean, that the other guys can win their section and still...
Absolutely. Well, Romania are a prime example. Romania finished... they finished fifth, and they had a first in section. To be fair, they had an absolute flyer in that peg, which was the end section on the dam wall. So they did have a good peg there, made the most of it, got their first in section, which is exactly what they needed to do. In the other two, they had a 9th and a 17th. Now, what's interesting is that if you get two good results, fair play to you, but you need three. You need three reasonably good results. Ideally, you need three very good results to win, but you need three really pretty reasonable results. Serbia, prime example, they had 2 seconds and a 10th.
Yeah.
Now, if they'd had 2 seconds and a third, they'd have beaten us, but they didn't, because their worst man or their worst pairing got 10th. So you're all, and what you need to do is you need to build whatever you can do in the lowest.
Yeah.
For a reasonable amount of time, we had a first and a second.
Yeah, yeah, I remember. So, I spoke to you at the time.
You know, and we couldn't believe it. We went in with a tactic. We had a three-stage game plan with an escape route if we needed it. And I'm not going to tell everybody exactly what that is because, well, quite frankly, I'm just not. So the situation was that we wanted to go in and we wanted to get quick bites because we took the view that as soon as we could get fish on the scoreboard, that would A, settle our nerves, B, that one fish that we caught early on might make the difference later on, which indeed it did, but also what it will do is it rattles the opposition.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of psychology that goes into this. Every nation has a runner behind each peg. Most of the nations have spies as well. So if a country's doing well, what they'll do is they'll put a load of spies around their swim to find out what they're doing, how they're doing it, when they're catching, etc., etc. So, you know, it's just unlike any other competition that I've ever been to before. But our game plan initially was to catch a few fish very quickly, which we managed to do. Neil and Chris, I think, caught the first fish of the event. Harry and Alexi had the first bite, but it fell off. Another one cut them off. Can you imagine for those two pulling a peg that's a decent peg, having two bites very quickly in their first ever attempt at the World Championships, and have both of them fall off? Now, it takes a lot to pick yourself up from that, because that is a kick in the knackers twice. And what I'll say about Harry and Alexi, if you put a fish within sniffing distance of them, they'll catch it. They are absolutely incredible anglers. They complement each other perfectly, and it doesn't take them long. They're very adaptable, and it doesn't take them long to work out what to do. And the French next door then started catching, and they caught three fish in comparison with the two that we'd lost. And suddenly we're thinking, wow, we might get a tatering in this swim.
Yeah.
And Harry and Alexi just... They got their stuff together within hours, because you haven't got days to think about this. You know, you've got to adapt and change very, very quickly. And they adapted, changed, caught, then caught, then caught, then caught, and just put the foot down. And they led that section, B section, all the way through until the very last morning. And if they'd have won their section, they'd have had individual silver medals. You know, it was an absolutely stunning performance there. Neil and Chris in A section... Sorry, in C section, they started out and they caught the first fish of the tournament.
Right.
And again, it was down to that, right, let's go. So quick bites were the plan first. Then we developed our sort of mid-stage, just like a marathon. And then what we had to do was up the pace towards the end. So, yeah, it isn't just a case of going fishing and trying to...
So
this is another thing while I'm wrapping off on one. A lot of people think when you go into a competition like this that it's about catching fish. It isn't. It's not just about catching fish. Catching fish is relatively easy. Anyone can catch fish. What you've got to do is catch more fish than anyone else.
Yeah.
And you've got to catch them quicker, and you've got to make that easier, and you've got to make it smoother. And the smoother, the quicker, the faster, and the more well-oiled your machine can be, the chances are the quicker you're going to catch fish.
So how many fish did each pair caught? Where did each pair finish in each section?
Well, our best result was Harry and Alexi. They came second out of A section. Like I say, they were leading it all the way through, and the fish would normally would feed in their peg just from first light until 10 o'clock. That was their main bite time. After that, they were scratching. And what they had to do was they had to absolutely capitalize on the fact that first light through till 10 was the time they were going to catch fish. Now, that's quite a difficult task, because what it means you've got to do is you've got to get all your prep done while it's dark.
Yep.
Now, if your bite time is 10 o'clock till 2 o'clock, which is when the Croatians had it, and believe me, I'm not taking anything away from the Croatians with this. They're phenomenal anglers. But it's a lot easier to have your bite time from 10 till 2 because you can prep in the light rather than your bite time at first light through till whatever. And if you miss that first light bite time, you've had it because you're only getting them just when the light's lifting. If you're catching between 10 and 2, you know that the light isn't having so much of an effect on the fish feeding, and they're there because they want to be there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to look at light levels. You have to look at all sorts of things as to what's triggering these fish to feed. The Italians, their period would probably come, again, from just after first light through to, thinking about it, no, they would start catching in the early hours of the morning until about 9 o'clock. So they're sort of straddled. So they had a very difficult task because, again, they have to be prepping through the course of the night, then catching through the course of the night, then sweeping up and then scratching in the day. So, again, it's about maximising your chances. If you've got a window of opportunity where you've got chances, you've got to catch as many as you possibly can in that window.
Yeah.
So the Italians, on the last day, incredibly, their bite time stretched a little bit longer up until lunchtime, and Harry and Alexi's morning bite time did not materialise. And they consistently caught 5 or 6 fish between 7 o'clock in the morning and 10 o'clock in the morning every single morning. And on the last morning, it didn't happen.
Wow.
And you know, there was... They could do it. Just they did what they'd been doing. They then adapted it slightly. They evolved with it, and nothing happened. And we got to 10 o'clock, which was the end of their bite time. And I remember I was down with Mark Bartlett and Chris at the time, and I rang them up and said, guys, the Italians are really pushing you, because they didn't know what was going on in their section. The Italians are really pushing you. The intel that I'm getting back is that they've caught quite a lot of fish. You've caught nothing this morning. They're within a couple of kilos of you now. I don't know what you can do. I don't know where you can get it from, but show me some of your magic. And they're like, right, okay. And to a man, irrespective, whoever it was in the team, if they were asked of something, they would do it straight away. It's like, show us your magic, just do something. I've got in the vehicle to drive over to their section. Again, it's going to take me over half an hour to get there. And I've got into an area of signal, met Neil Rivers, who was also on the bank running around here, there and everywhere. And he said, have you heard? And I said, what? He said, Harry and Alexi just caught one.
Wow.
And they'd never had a bite pre 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
For the previous, they'd managed to do something that got them a fish. So I've got around there, and we've found that they are now literally neck and neck with the Italians, but the Italians have got 2 to weigh. And we're thinking, wow, you know, this is really, really tight here. The Croatians had a good time as well. They caught a few fish. We hadn't caught the fish we needed to. Further down in the section, the Austrians had caught a few. The Dutch had caught a few as well. So it seemed that everyone else was settling in and we were drying up, which was a worry.
Yeah.
And we've heard the 15-minute hooter saying, right, warning, 15 minutes, that's it, it's going to be over. And I'm like, we need another fish. And we stood there, and at 2 minutes to 2, Alexi's rod rattled off.
Nice.
Now you get 15 minutes to land a fish afterwards. So we've heard the final hooter. I've had to shout fish on. Next door I've had to witness it. Marshall's had to come around and watch it. And how much pressure was on Alexi with that fish?
I can imagine that is one you don't want to drop off.
This is the extra time penalty in the World Cup, or it's the, you know, it's the golden goal, or it's the knockout.
Yeah.
This is it, and he had to net it. And the fair news, Alexi, I don't know if you know him, Jay, but he's on a different planet to everyone else. And I say that as a term of endearment and compliment rather than an insult. His mind is amazing. People may not know what he does, but he's actually doing a PhD at Oxford University in neuroscience. right. which is how the brain works. So potentially he is going to be a brain surgeon.
Yeah.
But rather than being the mechanic that fixes it, he's the bloke that understands how it works and what people can do to change it. He's so intelligent, and I've got to say again, his common sense level is fairly low, but his intelligence is incredibly high. And he's typically one of these very clever blokes that can apply his mind to stuff. Day of the week it is, he doesn't really know because it's not important. And he's unflappable. His mindset is amazing, and he compliments Mr. Charrington so well. They're an amazing pairing, and they've landed it. And that fish was enough to keep us where we were, and it was also enough to get them into second in section. 800 grams was the difference.
Wow.
If that fish had been 800 grams bigger, or if the Italians had caught one less, they'd have been silver medalists.
So for us older school people, that's just under £2, isn't it? Which is not a lot after, 4 days fishing?
No, that's right. That's right. So that's how tight it was.
So they finished second there. What about the other two pairs?
Billy and Jamie were on a split section. And what we found, they were on the head of the river at the very top end of the section. In the middle, in what I would class as an average to duff peg. We looked at it to begin with, and they're basically in a line with another 17 anglers.
Yeah.
But their peg was in a small bay that was set back 30 yards further back than everyone else. So you imagine you've got a bit of a handicap.
Yeah.
Straight away, you've got a bit of a handicap. But Billy and Jamie, they've been there before. You know, they know the score with it. Billy is like a machine. He's fast, he's quick, everything he does. When you watch him in the British Garp Champs, I remember seeing him when they first started, he scurries around the swim everywhere. He's a fidgeter.
Yeah.
He's always doing something. Jamie, completely the opposite. Slow, relaxed, solid. He's like a cart horse. If you put 10 ton on his back and said, carry that for me 20 miles, he'd do it no problem whatsoever. He is arguably the most unflappable person that I've ever seen. It's like, right, the house is on fire. What are we going to do? It's like, I'll just get this hose and pull it out. And that's what he does. And where they were really up against it. Where the split section was, and this was one of the question marks over the over the way the pegging ran. There was one section that had 7 pegs in it, another section that had 17.
Mm.
And with the 17 peg section, it was a straight line. With the 7 peg section, they were down in the deeper water down near the dam wall. That's where the overall individual champion came from. And the fish were all in the deeper water. So I'm not trying to justify a position. I'm just trying to explain the situation there, that there were some pegs that were much better than others.
Yeah.
In that particular section. So they've had a tough one. But you know what? They led the section to begin with. They started off the competition in the gold medal position. As it happened, they were overtaken, but they finished, I would say, an amazingly creditable fourth place in that. I think we probably should have finished seventh or eighth down there, which would have had a big effect.
Yeah.
But they finished fourth. There was one wobble where anybody that followed it through Facebook will have seen that we thought there was a steward's inquiry at the end. The information that was feeding through was that the Romanians were leading that section, the Croatians were second, and we were third, and we were happy with that. We then heard that the Serbians had overtaken us in that section, and we could live with that because we'd still got a couple of points breathing space elsewhere. But we then heard that the Spanish had caught a fish, which put them within one fish of us.
Yeah.
Now, Spanish home nation, they've got an end peg, really, really decent area. Typically, the Spanish catch a fish and it's 21 kilos. So, you know, it's a big, big fish. And on the last morning, we heard they caught a 9-kilo fish that put them absolutely on our heels. Yeah. Now, our spies told us this first thing in the morning because it was caught sort of, I don't know, 8, 9 o'clock, there or thereabouts. At 11 o'clock, the news came through that the Spanish had caught a fish. And we thought, that's it now, that's done us. Because in one of the other sections we've been caught, so that's done us, we've had it, and that's why there was a lot of doom and gloom. It later turned out that the fish that we found out about mid-morning was the one we already knew about from earlier on.
Yeah.
It just hadn't been recorded on the official scoreboard. So we needn't actually have worried. It's almost like someone scored a goal, and then 3 hours later you hear that someone scored a goal and assume it's another one, but it wasn't. It was the first one.
And it was just 9 kilo.
That was it. So it was only the 9 kilo rather than the 9 kilo plus the second fish. So the second fish was the first fish. So that meant that we had retained our position of fourth in A section, and that kept us up there. And then down into C section, this is where we had a bit of a change. C section was a straight line. We've got the Italians on our left-hand side, the Russians to the left of them. To the right-hand side of us, we've got Romania. And, you know, we are penned in an absolute battle with some very, very good nations around you. And I spoke about luck earlier. One of the things that there is an element of luck on is that, and again, I'll say this, I don't mean to be disrespectful to any of the nations, but some of the nations are better than others. You know, Croatia are phenomenal. And you fish out of a peg that has tapes marking where you can cast to. So you're not allowed to cast outside your area. You have a 25-metre window, and you've got pegs next door. There's a 10-metre space, then there's pegs next door. So you're not fishing very far away from your neighbours. Yeah. Now, if you've got a neighbour next door to you that can cast bait and land fish from 160 yards, you're up against it. Whereas if they can only fish at 100, then you've got the advantage.
Yeah.
And in C-section, we've got Romania, who individual world champions this year. They won the world championships title 2 years ago. You know, we've got them on one side and we've got Italy on the other side. We've then got Russia just the other side of them. So suddenly you don't have any advantage of being able to get that sort of advantage over your next door neighbours.
Yeah.
Neil and Chris have kicked off there. They've caught one straight away. Bang, they're up towards the top of the leaderboard. And C-section was the real tough one. That was the absolute scratching area. And it became apparent to me probably 24 hours in, that what had happened was the whole lake on that section had just closed down. And what the fish had done is moved out, because a little bit like when Chelsea play Man City or Man U or whoever you support, but when you get very, very big teams playing very big teams, a lot of the time they can cancel each other out.
Yeah.
And what happened along that section was that a lot of those teams cancelled each other's out because there were too many good teams fishing too well in a very small area. And the fish didn't have a chance. So what they did was they just backed away.
Yeah.
You know, if someone's making a bit of a hash of it next door to you, it might not affect the carp that much. But I've seen it in the BCAC where you get events where there's loads and loads of really good anglers. Sometimes you don't get a massive result because they all sort of cancel each other out. And that's what happened down there. So we thought, I didn't fish Mark Bartlett. I didn't start him. And the reason I didn't start him was because I knew he would be needed somewhere, but I didn't know where he'd be needed. And one of the main things that Mark Bartlett has is the ability to cast at ridiculous distances, but also to fish consistently and accurately there. Yeah. And, you know, Bart's the sort of bloke that he can put a rod out 200 yards if needs be.
Yeah.
But he can accurately and consistently fish at 180. He can bait over the top of it. He can PVA bag fish at that sort of distance. And I thought, you know what, we'll swing him into operation here, because if we can do that and fish 30 to 40 yards further out than everyone else, then we've got a chance. And the section had more or less died on its arse, Jay. There was nothing coming out at all. After those first couple of fish that Neil and Chris caught, that was it. So I think we'd either got a first or a second in section there. And I remember Barbara, the General Secretary of FIPS, said we had to ask for a substitution. And she said, you're crazy. Why are you substituting him in now? You're second in section. You're in the gold medal position. Why are you making a substitution now? And I just said, I can't tell you, but you'll see at the end.
Yeah.
And Mark went in, and nothing had been caught in that section for God knows how many hours. And in 20 minutes, he'd landed his first fish. And with an hour on the bank, he'd had another one.
And that was just being that extra distance, was it? Just
purely the distance. Purely the distance. And, you know, make no mistake about it, Neil Rivers came off. Neil Rivers is an absolute diamond of a bloke. He's, you know, he fishes very well. He knows exactly what he's doing. And he's a consistent 160-yard angler. Not caster, angler.
Yeah.
Now, you can speak to the majority of people and they'll give it the big one, beat their chest and say that they can cast Lord knows how long. And what they do is they put a lead on, they go into a field, they don't put a rig on it, and they're not fishing with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you might be able to chuck 160 or 170 in that situation, but I bet you can only effectively fish at 120.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when we started off, I said, you know, I'm not a small lad. I'm quite a big chucker. I'm sort of 140-ish. As a caster, and I think that, you know, big distances for casting make no difference at all. It's how effective you can fish, and I can fish at 140.
Yeah.
And I said to the lads before we started, they were saying, what can we do? It's like, you go out and you practice. And this is where Mark Hutchinson and Terry Edmonds came in. And my word, they, you know, they've played an absolutely massive part in this. All the lads went out to see at least one, if not both of them, on more than one occasion. And they were all chucking the lead in the field 200. Yeah. And even Alexi, who's he weighs about the same as a wet piece of tissue paper, and he's tiny. And I said to them before, and I want to be the worst caster in this team by a long way.
Yeah.
And they all went out and they did it. And you know what? When we went on that practice, I was. Wow. I was the worst caster by a long way, and I was hitting 160s. So that made a big, big difference. Neil came off, again, consistently fishing at that sort of 150, 160 distance. Mark went on, able to fish at 180. Happy days. There we go.
It proved to be a good substitution. I mean, we all the lads did fantastically well. They were the ones kind of in the firing line. They're the ones that had to do it. But, you know, we don't want to underestimate the fact that we're all armchair managers. You've been the one in the seat actually doing it. I liked how you picked everybody with kind of, you know, based on merit and based on who's in form, you know, who's actually smashing it at the minute. And then you did the super sub, the Mark Bartlett, Ollie Gunner, Solskjaer, which worked, because when you got him in, you managed to squeeze a fish after sighting, you know, where he might best be using them. I think the whole package, the fact that you did a PR job, you got the companies behind you, got the whole country behind you that were aware of fishing. I mean, I've never known about the World Championship until, usually it's already been going on or just finished when I've seen a write-up, you know, kind of after it. And everybody was waiting. People were apprehensive of the results when they knew we had a chance. And I think the whole package, the way you brought everything and everyone together is fantastic. You know, you deserve those medals as much as the lads that caught the fish, I think. And we, on behalf of the Carpcast, would like to say well done.
Brilliant. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's unquestionably a team effort. You know, it's a team world championships, but it's unquestionably a team effort. There's two guys that are in the team that we haven't mentioned that I'd just like to make mention of briefly before we move on for that. You know, I'm more than happy to take the plaudits for everything, but like I say, it's a team effort and everybody put their part in. And you've got Paul Booth over in Spain that a few people are like, oh, Paul Booth, who's this Paul Booth? Paul Booth didn't actually get a fish. I was going to bring him on the Sunday, but because it was so tight, we decided between us the best thing to do was not upset the apple cart, because things were working. But Paul was an absolute diamond. His knowledge of the river is impeccable. His ability to understand what's going on, and you know, it can be a micro change. And I'll give you one prime example. The scratching is going on Sunday morning in C section. And you know, we've now tickled a few fish out from distance, but things are drying up again everywhere. And we're just thinking, if we can get one or two more. And it was the micro changes that made the difference. And this is the thing that Paul bought in. He said, you know, you can be fishing an 18 mil pellet and they can work. It'll die off. If you stick out a double 14 or a 14 with a piece of corn on the end of it, sometimes that will be enough just to make them pick one up.
Yeah,
and it's almost like if they've been feeding on the feed, they've got used to the feed, they've had enough of that. If you put something slightly different out there, they know it's food, and it's just that different thing that will make them pick a fish up or make them pick the bait up. And that bought us two or maybe even three fish, you know.
Yeah.
Now, our team caught 38 fish in total, and I had a chat with the lads afterwards, and we were all sort of, you know, laughing and joking. It's like, which fish do you reckon won us that tournament? And the answer was every single one of them.
Yeah.
Every single one of them, whether it was the first fish that Neil and Chris caught on their quick bag tactics, let's get in there and catch a fish quick, or whether it was the one that Alexi caught just after the hooter, every single one of those fish won the World Championships for England on there. It was, you know, and just these little micro changes, just that intimate knowledge of the venue, of how if you drop short and you change and put a piece of plastic corn on, perhaps you can pick one up. That makes a big difference. Whereas, you know, people think, oh, well, we've just got to persevere on the pellets. And there were so many micro and macro things that we did that made a difference. And this is one of the things that makes me really proud, because you can go out and you can catch a fish, luckily, and you think, brilliant, you look at your trophy shot with it and it means a lot because you've got a nice picture. But if you've really worked for one, or if you've done something that makes a difference, and then you catch one because of that difference, that fish is worth an awful lot more. And you know what? An awful lot of our fish came to ever so slight changes. And from the outside looking in, they'll have seen us just doing what people think are a standard tactic. But there were little changes that were going on that made a big, big difference. And again, a little bit like Barbara, the secretary said to me, why are you changing when you're in the lead? You've got a second in section there and you're in gold. It's like, well, because I know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
And this is where the manager comes in. Because, you know, there was the issue of putting everything together in the first instance. There was the issue of trying to pull the trade together. There's then selecting the team. Then there's then dealing with the potential critics about why aren't I in it, or you know, just the general management of who should be in it and who shouldn't, because everybody has an opinion. But the biggest thing that the manager has to do is understand the game. And when that game starts, you know, you've got to get your best players in there, you've got to get the prep done, you've got to get all the other bits and bobs. But it's such a tactical thing when you're there, being able to understand what's going on in each section, who's catching you, who isn't. And, you know, the Serbians might be catching us in section C, but because they're not doing very well in A, we don't need to panic.
Yeah.
And it's very quick for whoever's in section C to think, oh, wow, the Serbians have overtaken us, we've got to put our foot down. Actually, you put your foot down, you might wreck what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, no, stick with where you are at the moment, because until they catch a couple more in D section, we're not bothered about them. We're only bothered about the Croatians, or we're only bothered about the French, or we're only bothered about the Romanians. And, it, you know, it's a massive, massive juggling act. And I was having to charge around all the individual different sections, see everybody, keep morale up. We got spotters out on the bank that were watching what was going on, feeding information back. And it's almost like my position was almost a call centre, receiving God knows how many calls about what's going everywhere, assimilating that knowledge, and then working out what we needed to do, where we needed to do, just to be able to stay ahead. Because just like in a marathon race, if you sprint too quick, if you haven't got the stamina to keep it going, then you could fall over your shoelaces. So there's an awful lot with timing as well.
So we did it. We won. Then we had ceremony. Then we had to get home, which looked a little bit of a not an easy feat. Both the vehicles broke down, I guess.
You say both. We had six.
Right.
We had four vans. My van went out in the middle of September, actually, for practice. I drove a load of stuff over. The lads flew over. I left it out there. And then the three pairs drove their vans over. And then a few of the lads flew over, so we had to rent a car. And also, I'll mention Ryan Need, Wayne Mansford and Tom Maker, who flew out just to give us a hand, you know, paid for it themselves under their own steam, came out and turned into an integral part of the team where they were helping out. And they had a hire car as well. And Wayne hit a rock and he lost his tyre. So we lost him for a short while he had to go into town and get a new tyre. The other hire car, that shredded a tyre on a stone. I hold a fuel line. On the way back up, Jamie's van, the gear linkage, kept popping off the gearbox. Mark Bartlett's clutch went. He had to be towed onto the ferry on the way back and towed off and then rescued. And unfortunately, on the way back, momentary lapse of concentration by me, 3 hours sleep a night for Lord knows how long. Unfortunately, not the best thing to do. But I clipped a curb and smashed an alloy, which meant that because the locking wheel nut key wasn't in the van, I've got a stupid VW camper van with rather smart alloys on it that need a specialist key.
Yeah.
And I got the one from where I'd had the old ones on, but I hadn't got the new one in, which was daft, and it was my fault. But the French guys couldn't get the wheels off. So I got stranded in France. The van's still out there at the moment. And I could, you know, the wheel's gone. What I've done is, fortunately, I was close to a fishery that I know. I know quite a few people over there. So I rang Andy at Chanteboeuf up and said, help. And fair dues, he came round. We rented a trailer. from the local hire place and just got it round to the fishery to see if we could sort it out ourselves there. I got Eurocover, but the only problem with it is I knew that it would be shipped away somewhere and it could take ages to deal with. So I thought, first option, I'll see if I can deal with it myself. So I was taken over to a lake and spent a day trying to sort everything out, which, as you can imagine, with hardly any sleep, it was just, I was properly emotionally low. All I wanted to do was get home, see my wife and kids, pat the dog, have a beer, bit of a celebration, and get back to civilization.
Yeah. Instead, you went fishing.
What can I do, eh? Sunday night, I slept in on the front seat of the van with all the kit because I was stuck by the side of the road. Monday morning, they came and collected me. Monday day was spent with mechanics, everything like that. Tuesday, I went to sleep. Monday night, I went to sleep. They told me that they could fly me back, but I couldn't get a flight back until Wednesday morning. So I had a good sleep on the Tuesday night, woke up a little bit fresher. Monday night, woke up fresher on the Tuesday, thought, I've got rods, there's a lake, I've got nothing to do, they've got to come out, and they did.
And you caught some fish.
And I caught some fish, and it was a really weird emotional rollercoaster ride, because ups and downs of the event, you know, the carp gods, or the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, they've given us a really decent start, then we were chased, then we've pulled away, then we're being chased again, eventually we've won the gold medal. It was absolutely fantastic. They've battered our vehicles on the way back up again. I've had a good night's sleep and then got the rods out, and within the first hour the left hand rod rattled off, and the fish went over the cord. I thought, oh, that looks half decent, and I was just about to peer into it when the right hander went, so I hit that one as well, and that was another half decent fight, and that's gone over the cord, and thought, ooh, that looks good. And the one was 42.10 and the other was 48.
That's pretty nice, isn't it? It's kind of a little reward from the carp gods.
It was indeed.
The carp gods certainly giveth.
Yes. Bracing a decent pair of fish like that is great at any time, but I've got to say, when the second one went over the cord and I looked at them and saw they were both big fish, I just turned into an emotional gibbering wreck again. Lack of sleep, all of the other bits and bobs, there was the tears were welling up in the eyes, and I was just thinking, I don't know whether I can take life at the moment, because one minute it's the highest high, the next it's the lowest low, and then it's back up and down again.
And by the time you'd had like 5 40s, you were just flicking them back if they didn't.
Well, you know when you hit it just right again, it got, I don't know if you remember last week, but it was just when the water was, or the weather was starting to cool a little bit, and there was a bit of an easterly wind, and it went from being quite nice to, after I left, they had the first frost, and I know that when you get the first frost, it can do one of two things. It can either really kick them in, or it can really kick them off. And I think I just landed there at the right time, because over a period of 16 hours fishing, I managed to land 9 fish, 5 40s and 4 30s.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I'd take that on any week's holiday in France, let alone a little 24-hour stop off.
Yeah, there we go. Well, I've just got to rescue the van now, that's all. I've got my locking wheel nut remover.
Yeah.
So we've got a spare out there that's okay. We checked that, that's fine. So the next one is I'm gonna rattle over there and see if I can reclaim the beast.
Yeah, and do a quick 24 hours. I mean, it'd be rude not to, wouldn't it? Well, if you've got to go and fetch it.
Well, if there's a lake there and there's rods in the van.
Cool.
Gotta be done.
Well, I'd like to say congratulations once again from Mark and myself, and I'm sure the rest of the Carpcast public. It's a fantastic achievement, and you've set the bar so high. we're not going to accept anything less than first next time. But is there any news on the next one?
There's a lot of news on the next one, actually. Yes, it's in France. The venue is kept under wraps at the moment. They haven't officially announced it. Fortunately, again, because of the fact that I've been overseas quite a lot and I've got quite a lot of friends in quite a few places, I've managed to tease both the location and the name of the venue out of somebody who couldn't keep a secret and desperately wanted to tell me. I know the lake, so yeah, it will be very interesting. We've got some massive news for next year with regards to what's going on, what we're going to be doing. I'll tell everybody at some stage. Well, I'll tease you all now with it, in that there will be squad expansions. We are going to be fishing more events, and there will be plenty more on the scene. But I think for the moment, it's time for us to sit back and just reflect on what we've done. Graham maybe, I'll just mention Graham and also Martin, because they've been integral parts of the team. Graham maybe was my assistant manager, and he is he's just an absolute diamond. He's a workhorse. He runs for Life Experiences down in Southampton, very good angler, and just he's a great organiser, great motivator, great man manager, and he loves the stat, which is good as well. So he's a brilliant part of the team. And Martin Hodgkinson, the River Ebro record holder, he was in as a techie advisor too and helped out like a diamond over there. But we were chatting about what's next. And because Graham's such a go-getter, straight away he was like, right, what can we do now? How can we prepare for next year? And I said, look, for the moment, let's just sit back and reflect. This is time for the lads to have a little bit of glory. They've achieved an amazing result against all odds. For a rookie squad to go out and go toe-to-toe with the undisputed champions of the world, Croatia, and for us to turn them over in what a number of people from a number of different nations are saying is one of the most epic battles there's been in the last few years. You know, we don't need to be looking at next year at the moment. What we need to be doing is just reflecting on where we are, what we've done, what we've achieved, and then we can settle down and move forwards in the future.
That's fantastic. I'm glad that we're aware of the lake, so we can kind of start planning. It's a fantastic result, as I say, and I'm already looking forward to the next one. You know, it's a good little adrenaline buzz to follow it all week. Congratulations and thanks for coming on and telling us about it.
Brilliant, no problem at all. Thanks to you, and also thanks to everybody for the support you gave us before, during and after the event. It really, really, really does, and I can't say this enough, it really, really does make a difference. When you hear footballers talking about the crowd lifting them, by God, you lads lifted us and kept us going. And you know, everybody, the public and the trade can pat themselves on the back, because everybody has played a part in this.
So a fantastic well done to the England Carp World Champions. And I'm really looking forward to the next one in France next year.
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed the way Rob kept everyone on the toes with his little videos on his Facebook and using the social media to keep everyone informed what was happening. I was at work. My phone was actually next to the till, or computer as it is. Just wait on silent, obviously, not to annoy people, but just waiting for the next update to come to see how we were doing.
Everybody wanted to know the results, and it all went quiet on the final morning. It went really quiet, and everybody, my news feed was full of it. Just like when shitty X Factor starts or something, and your news feed's just full of like the storyline. My whole news feed was full of England, and if nothing else, Rob did a fantastic job of making the country aware of it was going on in the first place. So yeah, it's brilliant. I hope they are all knighted one day. They need to win it a few times. A few times more, but yeah, and thanks Rob for coming on and telling us. And we've also been invited, that they're having an official party, a world champions party, and we've both been invited, Mark, so it'd be in November sometime,
oh, brilliant, look forward to that.
Something else I've seen on the net,
it's on the net, it must be true,
we like to give props to people. Now we did have some negative stuff to say about the Angling Trust once before, in the way they handled a couple of things, didn't reply to us to actually come and give their side, and without going over the negative stuff again, we would like to give props when we see something good, and I've seen some stuff on the net this week, which is fantastic. Basically, an angler's main gripe about the rod license is they don't really see things being done. You know, you see the Eastern Europeans or the poachers, they complain they never get checked for rod licenses and stuff. And I think that's kind of the bugbear for people buying rod licenses, is they're not actually seeing what's being done with their money. And I think that's one of the main gripes I see. But I keep seeing stuff on the net. The Angling Trust have done a number of things recently to tackle poaching. They've got those who are the they go out of the police pretty the voluntary bailiff service that they're doing. They're going out of police, and they seem to be doing quite a lot. Now I saw an article in it was in the Manchester Evening News and posted on a couple of sites where Greater Manchester Police responded to a call from a club who was aware of two people poaching with five rods each on their lake. They were taking pike and knocking them on the head to take them home. I'll read a bit of the report. An eagle-eyed venue regular spotted two men acting suspiciously, reported their activity to a club committee member. Member pike fishing with five rods each. They visibly killed a pike. So basically the committee member used the 101 non-emergency number and called the switchboard of the Greater Manchester Police, told them what's happened, told them it's illegal to fish with more than two rods, the guys had five each, told them they were killing and stealing the fish from a community lake managed by the community with the help of the local council and forestry commission. The key information here, which is why we have to thank the Angling Trust for this, is they supplied Greater Manchester Police with the deal sealer. Using the information available on the Angling Trust's page, the How to Report Poachers webpage, it's on the Angling Trust site. You basically, if you say certain things, which are on the Angling Trust website, the police have to respond to it because you've told them of a crime being committed, and there's certain legal codes of the law that these poachers were breaking that the officers have to investigate. And that's the key. It's not just saying, oh, somebody's trespassing on my land. You have to give them kind of the codes that are being broken, and the police have to respond. The police did go and they did arrest these people. I saw another one. I saw two police officers confiscating some carp tackle this week. There's a picture appeared on Facebook for fishing without rod licenses. And I think this is great. I like to see you know, these crime strategies in operation and working, and they clearly are. I mean, I've seen more stuff than I've seen in the last 10 years this year, so I think it's a great thing. And while we might not support everything the Angling Trust may do, you know, I'm open-minded to be won over, and this is definitely a tick on the Angling Trust book. So yeah, well done, props to them.
Yeah, got to give credit where it's due, and like you say, it's nice to see that license money is not being wasted.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I know they do stuff behind the scenes. You know, if you get a problem with a lake or water or anything, you know, you ring the EA, they will come. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we just don't see that they're doing, you know, fishery management every day of the week. So I'm not naive to think that, you know, nothing's going on. But your general public, they like to see stuff. You know, they like to see the EA bailiffs walking about, or maybe with the community service officers or these voluntary bailiff service. I think they're all good things. And I just think, you know, being what did the normal police used to call it? It's kind of like even though the police are there watching cameras and kind of behind the scenes, you like to see a bobby on the street to feel a little bit safer. You know, you see one walking past your house, you feel a bit safer at night from burglars and stuff like that. So I think it's kind of that visibility, you know, in plain sight. And then obviously with this voluntary bailiff service and then the CSOs and you know, it's being a bit more proactive, and I think people like that. I think we should. We've been teasing all the carpy knowledge. We do have probably one of the people that have studied carp more than anybody ever, I would say, is Mr. Simon Scott.
How you doing? All right.
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's a pleasure to speak to you. I think it's probably the first time I've ever spoke to you, although I did spend a lot of time down the RMC waters many years ago.
Yeah, I think we probably fished on the same lake on the same night once or twice, but I was thinking the same. I don't think we've ever spoken directly.
No, so no, I've read with interest much of your stuff over the years. It's great to have an encyclopedia of carp on the end of the phone.
Steady on, Jerry. I've agreed to do it.
Well, I mean, we generally kind of have a long form conversation. It's generally a chat more than anything, but as we do have somebody that is extremely knowledgeable, I apologise for probably going to ask you a lot of questions, which is not the way we normally do the interview.
No, that's fine. It makes it easy to answer questions, as long as they're simple, Jamie, obviously.
if you don't know the answer to a lot of these, I'm sure nobody does, so someone that's studied carp over the years. I mean, how did, were you a keen angler as a lad and naturally went that way work-wise because it was your passion, or how did you actually end up going into the industry?
My life with fish started on around the time of my 7th birthday. I won a goldfish at the fair that was that long ago that you could still win goldfish at the fair. Now obviously the animal rights wouldn't allow that sort of thing, but I won a goldfish. I threw a small ping pong ball into a glass jam jar. And to the horror of my father, who had given me the 5p or whatever it was to have a go, in it went, and I got presented with a small goldfish, and that lived in a ketchup jar for about 3 hours. So my start of fish keeping was not particularly successful, but obviously thereafter I started keeping pet fish, and on my 7th birthday I got given a rod and a reel, which came from Woolworths. It was a little tiny yellow reel and a little red rod, and I caught my first fish, which was a rudd from a local river, and that was that, really. So thereafter it's been a complete obsession, so just about everything I ever did when I was a child rotated around going fishing. School, everything to do with school, sport, everything was about when I could get home to go fishing again.
Yeah, I feel that. I think I was 9 when I got a similar rod.
I've still got mine. It's a fantastic thing.
Wow. Yeah, I don't have my early rods. It was begged, borrowed and stealed off family members then from that point onwards. Yeah. I was given boat rods and all sorts. But
of course, similar eclectic mix of stuff. I managed to keep hold of my first 2 or 3 rods.
Yeah, that's nice. And a perch was my first fish. You caught a nice one in a rod.
I caught
a decent start.
We had a very slow-moving section of the River Arun. Actually, it was a tributary of the Arun called the Curd, which rises in a little tiny village in West Sussex called Curdford, surprisingly enough. So they named the river imaginatively the River Curd. And this local bit to where I lived was virtually static in the summer months. It had a weir at one end, and it held the water back, and it had lily pads, and it was perfect rough habitat. And once I'd caught one, you got the hang of flicking out a float and maggots, you could catch one a chuck, just about. It was great fun. Many, many happy hours spent watching small floats disappearing beside lilies.
And when did carp come on the scene? When was your obsession with them?
I was about 7 when I caught my first rudd, and probably 3 or 4 years after that, I was actually on the same piece of river, and I'd been... a couple of guys who'd very much taken me under their wing, a gentleman called Trevor Lillywhite, another chap called Trevor Purser, and they'd very kindly spent hours fishing with me sat beside them. So I'd literally sit down beside these two old boys that fished on the river. I would pester them for information. So it must have done their heads in, thinking like where I am now and how it would be if a small child was pestering me. I think I'd probably thrown him in the river. But they put up with me for hours and hours just asking, why did you put that headshot there? Why does the float sit like that? Why did you put your rod tip under the water? Why did you cast there? What did you use? All this stuff. And they told me to try bread flake and sweet corn, because apparently that was a great bait for bream and tench, which were there were a few of those in the river. And I'd gone down to the River Curd, as I did most days, to be honest, and I set up in my usual favourite swim just before the big bend, and fished up against a lily pad, and I had a bite, which this fish went bonkers and smashed me up. and it left me deeply traumatized. And I sat there in an absolute pickle, and I remember thinking, if I'd known I was going to hook a carp, this thing leapt out of the water, so I could see it was a carp, it was a common, and before it smashed my line to pieces and disappeared into the reeds on the far bank. And I remember sitting there just in tears. I was just absolutely traumatized. After it seemed like a long time, I got myself back together again, enough to cast out again. I cast to the same spot, and probably half an hour later, the flick slid away. And this time, I hung on for dear life. I landed a mirror carp. It was about 7.5 pounds, and that was the first one. Actually, I've got a picture of it on the wall beside me at the moment. And yeah, happy days. that was quite a moment. I remember telling my mum when I got back, you mustn't tell anybody what bait I caught it on. It's absolutely top secret that I caught it on bread and sweet corn.
It's that I went through a similar sort of pattern from float fishing to hooking a carp, and that first one that you land, you know, after being snapped up a couple of times, which is usually your first couple of carp bites before you realise you've got to step things up a bit, and remember changing to five-pound line straight through, and I caught a similar size fish, probably 6 or 7 pound, and it was I left it in the net and ran home, which is about a 15-minute walk, so a 7-minute run or something. I ran home to tell my dad, and I've caught this massive fish, you know, and I was a carp angler from that second onwards. It was such a, it was so enthralling, and you know, I loved fishing anyway, but that first carp, that was the one, you know, the first time I landed one, I was a carp angler from then.
Yeah, I'd say the same. I was, from that moment, I trying to engineer to catch more carp. I just thought that the way they fought, the excitement, it was the addictive stuff, isn't it? And you start to, your kit starts to evolve quite rapidly from that point onwards.
Yeah, it started probably similar to you. Started with like one rod ledger in, and you still kept the float rod for the action, you know, and for something to do, with just sort of one rod left out all day, hoping for a bite. And that, you know, there comes a point where you get more excitement out of sitting with nothing for 10 hours and with the chance that you might get a carp bite, that I'd rather have two rods out for carp. I remember the day I got two matching buzzers, BJ bite alarms. They were that day of having two parallel rods and matching buzzers was a big deal. And
I don't think I've got that yet, Jamie. I don't think my rods match yet. Wow. That happened a long way down my carp fishing career when I actually got a set of gear that looked the same. But I was given a 10-foot carp rod that reputedly was made by the Queen Mum's gardener. And I was given that by a gentleman that my father knew called Bob McIsaac, and he presented me with this thing and said, you could try that for your carp fishing. And it had a screw-in swing tip fitting halfway down the blank, so between two eyes. So I used to have a Shakespeare ledger rod, which would have a washing up top bottle hanging on it. I'd have my green float rod, which was 2 foot longer than the ledger rod. And then beside that, I'd have my 10-foot Queen Mum's gardener carp fishing rod. So all my bite indication was all different all over the place. I didn't have buzzers at that point. The rods were all different lengths. I was quite a sight to behold. But I caught carp on all of them in the end, just about.
What's the strangest bait you've ever caught on? Did you ever sort of, I mean, we tried sweets and all sorts back then, licorice. Do you ever sort of catch on any weird baits back then?
Yeah, I did. I read at quite an early age, I read Carp Fever. I remember seeing that in a shop in Guildford for sale. It was a sort of sports shop that did air rifles and shotgun cartridges and bits and pieces. They had some fly fishing gear, and they also had a little tiny book section, probably 50 books, no more, of all sports, you know, you could buy in there. And I remember I'd put on my Christmas list, I can't remember how many years ago it was now, but Carp Fever was on. I put a carp fishing book, and I'd put a little sort of sign to Mum that you could buy this in Guildford in the sports shop halfway up the high street. So I made it very clear what I was after. And yeah, she came good. And I remember in there was a bait that you made up using gelatine. And I made up, so I stole several boxes of my cat's food. And when my mum was out one day, I put the whole lot through the blender. And reduced it to powder, and I followed the instructions that were in Carp Fever. Kevin had failed to mention that it would actually stink when I was cooking it, and that I'd need a baking tray and a few other bits and pieces. So I had a sort of a mad 2 or 3 hours of my mum out trying to make this bait and then put it in the fridge to set it all. And she came back to find kitchen chaos, which resulted in me obviously getting a very sore backside. But I made this gelatin bait and I caught carp on it straight away. It was amazing. And actually I've used it quite a lot since, but that still remains probably the weirdest bait I've ever made. And you could do all sorts of stuff with it, I discovered later.
So it's basically like dry cat biscuits, like munchies or something they were called.
Yeah, so you just basically put them through the food blender to dust. And then I mixed up this really strong gelatine jelly mix and then mixed it through that. And then you laid it out in a tray to set. And then I diced it up into cubes, like luncheon meat cubes, and used to fish those. And it worked brilliantly, and still does. But the early prototypes in the kitchen at home were quite unpopular with my mother. So it's basically
like a meaty sweet.
Yeah, but you could add all sorts to it. So I went through, you know, I tried everything. Anything my mum had in the cupboard, I would pour in it. So, you know, vanilla flavouring and lemon flavouring, everything that she had.
I went through a similar bait making period when I was young, mainly because I couldn't afford boilies and stuff. It was like my 7 days paper round, basically bought a bag of Richworths back then. So we made loads of stuff. But yeah, the vanilla essence used to come out of the cupboard regular. That'd go in a lot of stuff, anything.
We used a lot of luncheon meat. I had a friend called Philip Bentle, and Philip and I used to fish once we'd kind of got a venue to go to that had carp in it, we'd fish a lot with luncheon meat. And the usual routine was you would fish for a couple of hours, dead serious, really up for it. And then, of course, you'd get bored. And so you'd have a luncheon meat fight using catapult. We'd fish on pontoons next to each other. They'd probably be 15 meters apart. So you would then dice up your luncheon meat and just basically fire at each other. So the boilies followed the gelatin. A gelatin bait to start with, then luncheon meat, and then once we got fed up with just constantly smelling of luncheon meat, of course, after a proper battle, after, you know, two cans or three cans had been fired at full tilt at one another with catapults, your hair was full of it and your clothes were covered in it. We started to make inroads into boilies at that point. And I remember the first boilie was Duncan Kay's purple patch boilies, and it was a flavour called Carpy, and they were bright pink.
Yeah. Yeah, I do remember those. We had a tackle shop near us. It was probably ahead of its time back then, but yeah, you used to get all the Rod Hutchinson flavours in. I used to make my own, and I remember those like pinky ones. So you didn't want to do anything else when you left school, that you were going straight into fishery management course?
Unfortunately, I was branded quite early on in my school career as dyslexic, which is something I still live with today, but it meant I really struggled with any of the written work at school. So I remember trying to learn French, and just like, I struggled enough with English. And I remember I had sort of various meetings at the school, and my parents came, and I remember then my mother being told that unfortunately, Jamie, when I was at school, I struggled a lot with academic subjects. So I got statemented at a very early age as being dyslexic. And at that point, we're going back a few years now, dyslexia wasn't that well. No, they didn't know about it much. And, you know, basically when I was about 15, I had a reading age of about 9. I really struggled with school. So anything that involved being in a classroom, writing down notes, that sort of learning just didn't suit me at all. And I was very, very passionate about anything to do with fish and also the outdoors. So I like anything outdoors at all. And somewhere along the lines, I guess my father, you know, realised I was passionate about fish. And he did a bit of homework, and he found a place called Sparsholt College where you could do a course in fisheries and fish management. And so that was kind of my goal. If I could get there, I thought this would be all right. And I remember struggling along through my A-levels, and I did a deal with my dad that
if I wanted to go to Sparshot, he said you must try and do at least an A level or two. He'd done his homework and thought that the best opportunities would come if I'd stuck it out a bit longer at school. So I did. I did geography and biology for my A levels, which made most sense to me rather than some of the other subjects my friends were doing. And I got those, and then I went off to Sparshot to do fishery management, and it was just like the light came on. It was just an amazing experience. Suddenly, I was in classrooms talking about fisheries management, which I just totally get, and I, you know, as opposed to history and maths, which I'd struggled with, this suddenly made a lot of sense. So that was me sorted.
And then you went on to become a tutor there as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. So I was there as a student for 3 years. So at that point, there wasn't a degree you could do. There's now 2 degree courses at Sparshot College. But I did a three-year higher national diploma. Then I went to Plymouth University and did a master's degree in applied fish biology. Then I went off and did a few bits and pieces in the industry. And then a job came up for teaching at Sparshot. I went for it and got the job. And I was there for the best part of 20 years. 20 years, yeah. This year, I've just given up now. So it's been. I was there for a long time teaching fishery management. So it was a good place to be taught and a great place to go back and teach at as well.
Yeah, it's great that you know the passion in your life, even if you did have kind of you know handicaps or hiccups by not being able to go into or finding conventional stuff difficult, you had a tailor-made career really that just suited you perfectly by the sound of it.
Yeah, no, I did. I was very lucky and incredibly lucky to get the chance to go back and teach at Sparshot because, you know, that kind of suited me. And having struggled a bit myself at school, it kind of helps from my own teaching to have a bit of an understanding that a lot of the lads that were in the classrooms I was teaching were probably in a similar boat to what I was when it came to writing notes and the like. And somewhere along the line, going back maybe 10 or 12 years now, the sort of fish farming business started as well, and that built up as we sort of tailed off at Sparshot, so it's worked quite well.
Is that the main thing you're doing now fish farming?
As I say, 10 years ago, Viv Shears and myself sat down and we felt that there was an opportunity to, I don't think at the time we'd planned to sort of become full-time fish farmers as such, but I loved growing fish. I've always grown. I've had pet fish. I've got pet carp now that I've had since I was at school, just about. So, I've got several ponds in the garden. I'm passionate about growing fish. I like growing stuff as well, plants as well. So I kind of had the fish farming vibe all along. And about 10 years ago, Viv and I decided that we'd found a little potential site that we might have a go at growing some carp, and it grew from there. And which we then called it VS Fisheries, or Viv and Simon Fisheries. Yeah. And the idea was that, you know, that would just be sort of supplemental to working at Sparshot, but that grew and has done very well. So as that's got bigger, obviously we've had to reduce the amount of time we'd be at Sparshot. And as I say, this year I finally decided that something had to give, and I'm afraid Sparshot was that. So at the moment now, yeah, I'm pretty much full-time carp farmer, and then do private consultancy work at fisheries, look after a few private ponds and lakes, and also do obviously quarter work, bits and pieces for quarter when I can, and consult for bait works as well. So I seem to do all sorts of different stuff, which is, variety is the spice of life, Jamie.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen you on the Thinking Anglers. I mean, it looks like you're kind of like the up close and personal, the stalking, you know. It seems to be that you've studied carp, and would you say that's your favourite type of fishing as well, when you can sort of see what's going on?
It definitely is, Jay. I love to say it's because I've studied and I'm good at catching them in the edge, but the truth is, if it'd been known between you and me, I can't cast for toffee. So it's much better if I backwind it in the edge. I can just about lower a rig onto a small spot. If I had to cast it 100 yards, I'd be sunk. So I admire Dan and Daryl, and they're blasting it to the horizon. I can't try. I've tried, and yeah, I just can't do it. I look like I'm having some sort of seizure. So unfortunately, I just have to accept if they're showing 100 yards out, I've either got to walk around the other side and chuck it at them, or I'll just drop it in the edge and wait for them to turn up. So I suppose, and also not having a lot of time, I think has contributed quite a lot. So being a relatively short, you know, I don't get big blasts of time. I never get the chance to go out and do 5 or 6 days fishing in a row, sort of session fishing as such. I'm often short sessions. So the sort of stalking approach, walking around, looking lots, it suits me down to the ground. And I suppose I tailored my approach to that, really.
I always associate you with the RMC waters. I'm guessing Sparshot had some sort of contract to manage their waters or look after them, did they? Or
cause nothing as formal as a contract, Jamie. We through at the time as my sort of position at Sparshot as a lecturer was sort of, you know, I got very settled into it and I was running a courses and stuff, and we were looking to obviously make the courses slightly more up to date, modern, related to carp fishery management. I contacted Ian Welsh and then Viv, who was assistant fisheries manager at RMC, and I knew Viv reasonably well. He'd been a student at Sparshot himself, and we got a good rapport going, and we would often take student groups to RMC venues to do fishery management work, you know, to sort of actually take snags out and do some of the bits and pieces that you know, that RMC never had that a big number of staff as such. You know, they had lots of voluntary workers, so we were able to say, well, we'll bring a minibus of lads and we'll do a netting and we'll try and catch fish out here or there, and obviously for myself it was just fantastic because I was able to go to the lakes I dreamt about visiting, and pull nets through them and do tree work and snag removal and get involved in actually their management. So I just absolutely lapped it up. So it's good fun.
Is that how you developed a passion for Raysbury? That must be one of your
The passion for Raysbury started a bit before that, really, because somewhere along the line, I bought Tim Paisley's book, Big Carp, which I think he published in about 1980. I bought it in W.H. Smith's in Winchester when I was still at Sparshot as a student. Mm-hmm. And I read that, and in that book there are pictures of Pete Springate holding carp from Raysbury, and I remember reading Pete Springate's chapter over and over and being absolutely captivated. I just thought, to fish such an enormous lake with such an unknown, you know, stock, and the fights he talked about were immense. I just thought that almost from right early on, you know, when I was still a student, I thought I'd like to go to Raysbury, but I didn't want to go there straight away. I wanted to try and tailor my fishing. You know, I know we get guys now, and it's no criticism, the world's changed, but, you know, you get young lads now that go straight onto waters with huge fish in them, and they catch them, and then they kind of, they've done it all, and, you know, they're 18 years old and they've caught 50s and whatever. I was quite keen to try and sort of gradually progress through it so that I didn't catch the biggest fish too soon. So I went to Burfield as a warm-up water. So I cut my teeth on Burfield for a couple of years. Caught a few from there. And then once I decided I'd kind of got the hang of walking around 100-acre gravel pit, I set off to Raysbury. What a place to go. I mean, just at that point, Mary was the British record, and it was an amazing venue to go and fish, and it was a very wild, you couldn't walk around it, the stinging nettles were 10 feet tall. It was just a beautiful place to fish, and the boats, we could use a boat, so that kind of took the fishing a step further as well, so you could really get an insight into what they're up to. So suddenly, as a stalker, like stalking around the edges of a lake looking for fish, you could do that 200 yards out in the lake. So it kind of it suited me perfectly.
It's great boat fishing, isn't it? Just answering those sort of, you know, if you're a thinking angler and you're wondering what's going on out there and you've seen fish show and wondering if they've eaten any bait, or, you know, it answers all the questions, doesn't it, just being able to go and look.
Oh yeah, and the in depth, you learn so much about what the fish are up to. The minutiae detail of their day to day lives, you can completely clock it from that boat. So as you say, you at Raysbury, I was farming spots. I was putting a dropper of hemp here and a dropper of hemp there. You were looking at to see if shells on the bottom had been turned over. Yeah. You know, that really looking in depth at what was happening. And I just absolutely lapped that up. It was fantastic. So once I'd started there, I obviously, you know, you bites at Raysbury, you tend to remember them all. And I think I can pretty much remember every single fish I caught from there, exactly where I was, what the bite was, you know, the whole lot. It was really intense fishing, very, very exciting.
And you obviously finished up with catching the British record, Mary. Was it 52 you had it at?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I thought that bit of my plan didn't quite pan out, because I had originally, I really, really wanted to catch Malins, the carp called Malins that was in there. That was at the time when I went to Raisbury, it was about £39. And that was the fish I liked the picture of the most. So looking in some of the books, I'm just trying to think which book it is now. It'll come to me in 2 seconds. Dave Lane's book. In Dave Lane's book, there's that fabulous picture of Malins. And he's holding Malins in one of the colour plates. And in the other shot, he's got Mary's mate. And that shot of Malins just I thought, what a magnificent fish. So, and virtually on my very first walk round Raisbury, I found Malins under a bush, and I had a can of sweet corn in my pocket, and bizarre, I couldn't believe it. But I crept down in amongst the bushes and brambles, and I started chucking in grains of sweet corn, and this massive fish was taking them on the drop, and I thought, this is incredible.
Yeah.
I've walked round, I found one, and it's eating it. And I put the whole can in, and it got, the fish was joined by a couple of others, and I got set up that night. I was unable to tie a hook on. I was so excited. And needless to say, absolutely nothing happened that night, but I did learn a lot from that walk round. So that was when I set off at Raisbury. I wanted to catch Malins. That was the fish I went for. And I started off with catching a couple of the stocky commons. And then I caught measles, which was a very old Raisbury fish, upper 20. And then I caught a couple more stocky commons, and then I was sat up in the root nightmare. It's a long story, I won't go into the fine details, but I was in the root nightmare. Some bloke called Jim Shelley was in the next swim down to my left in the Mad Dog. Yeah. And in the night, I'd had two stocky commons, and these are normally quite tricky customers to catch. I'd had a pair of them. One was 19 and one was £20. And Jim Shelley, bless him, had christened me the pest control officer, and because I kept catching these stocky commons. And I had a bite at 10 past 10 that wasn't a stocky common, and it was Mary at 52.
Nice.
And Jim did all the rowing in the back of the boat as I set off out into the lake, and together we landed her. And big fish, awesome carp to catch. So I caught Mary reasonably quickly.
Wow. What a fish. I mean, you know, that's one of my kind of bucket list regrets, you know, not having to go for that fish when it was alive. I mean, that's...
Oh, it was just an awesome fish. Everybody I'd met up there had said, you'll know when it's Mary because it'll do like 40 or 50 yards on the take. And all the two stockies that I had in the night before I caught Mary had fought like trains. I was convinced that they were big ones, and then they come up in the weed and you net them in the weed and you're out there in a little dinghy with a head torch on, and it's all chaos. And then I was sat with Jim Shelley when the bite came at 10 past 10, and it was a stormy, wet, horrible day, and there's a weed on the lines, and this bit of weed, there was a single bleep, and this bit of weed tented up over the line as the line tightened, because it was obviously coming from the tip down to the lake quite straight down, because the weed was up against the lines. And this bit of weed just lifted clean out of the water, and then it absolutely rattled off. And I ran to the rod, and Jim goes, I'll get the boat. And I went, oh, it's only going to be another stocky common. And he was like, don't be daft. No one catches three stocky commons in a row, not even the pest control officer. And anyway, he rode from the Mad Dog back up to the Root Nightmare swim, which, now let's be honest, Jim is a strong man, but he's not a super athlete. He rode up there, he got to my swim, still puffing and panting and all sweaty. We leapt in the boat and it's still taking line, and you're thinking, this is not a stocky common. It went like a train.
Wow. And you've been involved in the new Raisbury, as it were, really, with you know, that they, since obviously it's been sold and it's been stocked, and was that your doing? Were they your fish, yours and Biv's?
Yeah, a lot of our fish went in there. RK Leisure been very good customers of ours. Thank you to them. And yeah, it's a strange thing. I mean, obviously, I remember Raisbury with 44 carp in it, and being the lake in its entirety, 120 acres. But you know, it's things change. Business is business. I'm very sad, you know, that it's changed. But I totally understand. You know, I should have bought it if I wanted to keep it the same. I didn't have the pocket money to do that. And they've obviously got a vision for what they were trying to do, and so they came to us for fish. And you know, you've got to sell your product, haven't you? So.
We sold a fair lot of fish to them that have gone into both the North and the South Lake at Rosebery. And from what I understand, they're doing incredibly well. It's a very, very rich environment, Rosebery, so I'm sure they will be huge fish in the future in their own right.
What originals are left?
I'm not altogether sure now. I've lost touch a little bit in the last 12 months or so. I know some of the fish that I put 10 fish in there when I was still lecturing at Sparshalt. So I picked out 10 and grew them at the college, and they went in there. And most of those, I think 7 of those made it through out of the 10 we put in, and they're still going. And 3 or 4 of those are 40s now that regularly get caught. I'm not sure about the actual, you know, the real originals. I believe that Jacko's Common's still going. I think 3 Scales is still going. So, there are a few in there still. They'd be very, very old fish now.
What would you class King Fungus as? Would you class it as an original? Because, it seems to vanish, then seems to get caught a lot. And I always was under the impression it kind of came from somewhere.
I think Ian Welsh put that fish in. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the date. I've got them somewhere written down, but I've got a sort of chronological, listing of all the stockings. But Ian Welsh put that in his time at RMC, so that wasn't one of the sort of the Mary Malins clustered batch that went in. That was it came quite a bit later than that, and not dissimilar time to when the Commons went in, the Redmark Commons, I believe. That fish, we used to see that fish all the time, and I remember talking to anglers and saying, people would say, "Oh, you're fishing at Rosebery. Is this king of the fungus mirrors? Is this a real fish? Is it for real?" And the thing is, as we touched on earlier, with the boats, there was no question. You would go out and you could get in the weed in the Railway Lake area, you could get within 5 feet of this massive mirror carp with this huge slash on its flank. You could put your thumb in the groove right down its... It looked like it had been hit by an axe. And you could see it as clear as a bell. And this fish hadn't... The last capture of it was sort of 14 pounds. Yeah. And then it got caught at an upper 30. So it was definitely there. A magnificent fish as well.
And what size were the stockers that you put in recently then?
The ones that we've stocked, most of those that left the farm were either C4s or C5s. So C4 is a fish that's 4 summers old. So it'd be sort of 7 to 10 pounds. And then a C5 would be sort of 12 and a half up to maybe 15, something like that. So that's the sort of size of them. It's a nice size to buy a carp, because if you buy a carp at C4 size, they're quite bulletproof.
Yeah. We found that when we've stocked fish. In fact, did we ever get any off you? The Dead Man's Lake in Manchester. We've had 3 or 4 sources over the years. I'm not sure if we had any of yours. But we put them in at different sizes, even from the same fish farm. We've definitely had some handicap fish in there. And we had a batch of C4s. I think all bar one survived. We had 2 stockings, one of mirrors, one of commons, probably 30 odd fish in each. We maybe lost 1 or 2. Then we had half a dozen kind of 18 to 21s, and I think they all went, within a couple of years. Maybe one survived, if that. Reason in that lake, when you put them in bigger in that lake, they just don't seem to survive.
I think C4s, I often get customers ask, what size would you recommend? And it's tricky because you obviously you're selling the fish, but I always think that the best size to buy a carp, in my experience, obviously others will have different views, but is a C4, so 4 summers. So that if that gives you a fish between maybe 7.5 and 10 pounds, you hear people say, "Oh, we've got C4s that are 12 pounds and 14 pounders." We've had some C4s that size, but as a general rule, around 8 to 10 pounders. That is past the size that a pike's going to have a good go at it. It's past the size that a cormorant's likely to have a go at it. They're pretty tough at that size. If you put them in at 4 pounds or maybe 4.5 and they get had by a 25-pound pike and that leaves them battered or a cormorant gets hold of them and has a good old go, then you're going to lose a few. And I think if you're going to spend good money, I think at C4s you're getting good bang for your bucks. You're not talking ridiculous money.
You know, if you've got a few thousand pounds as a budget for your fishery, you're going to get a good number of C4s. So it makes it a worthwhile stocking. And they're still at that age that they're adaptable. You know, they're like feisty teenagers that can settle in really well, as opposed to stocking your grandmother.
Yeah, I mean, and if you buy 100 C4s and then, you know, you're literally, yes, you're losing a couple of years, but, you know, if you go and buy 120 pounders, the price difference between the two is quite significant, isn't it?
Yeah, and we've stocked 20 pounders from the farm that have gone on to carry, and they've carried on growing at really good rates in very rich fisheries. You know, we've certainly stocked some 20 pounders out that have done very, very well and become, we had a text message a few weeks ago actually from a guy who bought a couple of 20 pounders for his lakes, and one of those is nearly 40 now, and it's wow. You know, it's pushing on really well. He sent me one of those lovely texts you get in the early hours, you think, what's happened now? And it's like, check this out, wow. And this photograph of a, you know, big smiley face holding his huge mirror. But we've also stopped places with some bigger fish and some C4s, and often the C4s just seem to settle in better and they're better able to adapt to the environment and push on to become the bigger fish at the end. So yeah, I always say to people, if you want a couple of big ones to start, you know, so you've got something that's £20 as a kickstart, that's fine, but I would spend money on C4s.
How do you find like the kind of biomass of fish? Do you find, I remember speaking to somebody once that said there was in every stock, so whether it's a 10 acre lake with 50 fish in it or regardless of kind of the ratio, but there's always, you know, a percentage of the fish will be in kind of the bottom third of the weight bracket, the bulk of the fish will be in the middle bit, and then you'll get your flyers. And does that ratio kind of stay true regardless of how big the lake and how many
fish
are in there?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, can't form hierarchies, Jamie, in any population, whether there's 10 fish in the lake or 110 fish in the lake, they're going to form a hierarchy. You get it in a pond as well, in a growing pond. So if there's 5,000 carp in a pond, you will get the most aggressive fish becoming the dominant fish. And therefore, by being the most aggressive, they get the most food at every feeding opportunity. And because they get the most food, you know, they become the biggest fish. What's really interesting, and you, in a growing pond scenario, you can completely reshuffle the cods. If you take those fish out and then regrade them and put them back in, some of the fish that were at the bottom of the pecking order can actually do brilliantly. And we had a customer a few years ago that rung up the farm quite late in the harvest and said, I've only got a very small budget. I'm desperate for a handful of fish. And we only had a few 7-pounders left. And we were like, these are really the bottom end of the C4s. We weren't planning to sell them, sort of thing. And he said, no, they'll be fine. They'll be fine. And he stocked them in his lake, and they have gone off at a phenomenal rate. And so it just goes to show, if you change the pecking order around, if you reshuffle the cards, often somebody else will bob up to the top and be the dominant fish.
I've been
told that. Sorry, 20 years ago, a guy that a lot of respect for told me that. He said, if you keep the biggest fish always, they're not necessarily in the long term going to be the very biggest fish. They're just the most aggressive at the moment. So I always try and have a bit of a mixture to spread the chances about of having a real whopper.
I've seen so many big fisheries that have become sort of circuit waters extremely quickly, where a stock of maybe older fish have been moved over from one of the other lakes on the complex, and you know, maybe they were just overstocked doubles, you know, in a smallish lake. They get put into a 15, 20 acre lake, you know, the same 30 fish that had been in this 1 acre puddle, and they're not young fish, you know, they might be 10 years old or more, and they fly as soon as you put them in the other lake. I mean, off the top of my head, the Shallow Lagoon on the St. Ives complex, I mean, that's how them fish all went crazy in there. I mean, they're all put in out of one of the little lakes on the complex, and they just flew. It had done 240s in about 3 years. And the biggest fish that went in was, I think they varied from like 18 to 26 pound and hadn't really changed in the little lake. And they just flew, you know. And now one of them, obviously, Colin's gone 50, and there's other 40s in there. I've seen that happen a few times. And is that the case? Just what, like, if you have overstocked an overstocked lake with, where the fish maybe are stunted or not reaching their potential. When you move them into a bigger lake, they just kind of make up for lost time, or...
Yeah, we'd call it recovery growth. So they're basically just recovering that, you know, up to their genetic potential, and they're just catching up effectively. And yeah, I've seen exactly what you've described. I've seen exactly that happen on many, many occasions where match fisheries have destocked and they've sold fish, and people say, "Well, I don't want those to come out for match fishery," and they've gone into a lake with loads of food in it, and it. I also kind of like their personal story, because imagine the hardship that they've been in, a really heavily pressured, really difficult environment where they're scratching about for every cast or every maggot, and they're getting pulled out every week and spending hours in keep nets and then being weighed, and then they suddenly go into a lake. They must be like going into Harrods food hall with a voucher that says eat as much as you like. You know, they must just be a lovely for them. And of course, as you said, they grow at Ellerborough. I can think of lots of places that I've seen that, you know, fish that are put on £10 a year for 3 years, and they've gone in at £10, then 20, then 30, then £40 in literally no time at all. It's exciting to see.
And is it the same thing? It's the hierarchy you're talking about. When like the biggest fish in the lake dies, one always seems to replace it really quickly. Like, is that yeah. pecking order? Somebody else goes.
Well,
on
that will be a high. Yeah, that would be a hierarchy for me. So, yeah, you see that in, you know, under the belt feeders at the farm, we'll get the most dominant fish sitting under the belt feeder, and if you take the number one fish out, and often he's the biggest one, you take him out of the way, there'll be somebody else that will just step in and fill their shoes, and the same thing's happening in a fishery. Exactly, he's the lead fish.
So if like every few years you took the biggest fish out, dropped it in another lake, let another one come through, move that, let another one come through, move that, and then put them all back in, what'll happen? They just fight to the death.
You get a load of really cheesed off anglers, wouldn't you? Not sure where the fish is that they're trying to catch at the moment.
Yeah, but you could engineer lots and lots of the big fish by removing the bigger ones regularly.
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, as a fishery manager, there's, you know, lots you can do to try and to create that perfect habitat, isn't there? To try and get as much food in there as possible and get the water quality absolutely spot on. Yeah, I mean, I think fishery management now has moved on. You know, in people are getting better understanding of how to make the perfect environment for carp to grow really well. I mean, you go back 20 years and if a lake had more than a handful of fish in, it was overstocked and they were never going to get really big, and that's changed now. You have to take the example of somewhere like Oxley's on the Linear Complex, which is a relatively heavily stocked environment. But the amount of bait that goes in there, the water's spot on, it's a well-managed fishery, and look at the size of the fish. Just absolutely huge. Yeah, and not just one or two big ones, there's loads of big fish in there.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Everybody's dream one day is to have their own lake, isn't it? And everyone who's been passionate about fishing. So I kind of ask these things with a view to, yes, what would I do? You know, how would I run a lake? You know, obviously, as has happened with Raysbury, I mean, you can have a dream lake, and if you've got very deep pockets and you know, make it the perfect carpers fishery, but really, I mean, you know, things cost money. It costs money to maintain. They obviously spent a lot of money purchasing it, and you know, it's a commercial world we live in. They have to make money, and I kind of like, you know, it's never, I'd have loved to fish Raysbury as it was. I spent some time with Jim on there when we did his first book. You know, we sat in the pegs. His friend Marky Mark sadly died on there, was fishing there at the same time. We spent the night there and he sat me in the pegs and told me the stories, you know, in each peg, including your capture, including that night. And it's, yes, it was magical, but, you know, it's a different business now, and I really want to fish it. I've not been down there yet since RK have had it, but I can see myself going in the future. And I've seen the people that have kind of, you know, slated it, including Jim, who's very disappointed at what's happened. It's, you know, I own businesses as you do now, and it's just the way the world works. You can't.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. I understand people's emotions and people getting really upset about it, but I also say to people, well, you know, you take somewhere like Raysbury, if you go back 100 years or so, it was a field. Yeah. It wasn't a carp lake at all. And, you know, to I think you have to try and look at it and think, well, things move on. You know, if it wasn't for development, that lake would never have been dug in the first place, because the gravel went off to become a motorway and a runway and a housing estate. So, you know, things change, you know, and progress happens. And, you know, unfortunately, unless you've got the money to buy it yourself, then you've got to accept that other people will, and they've got to do things with it.
Yes, and well, you might be able to dispel or maybe prove a few myths for us. The effect of the moon.
This sounds like a tricky question coming, Jamie.
The effect of the moon. Do you notice when obviously you're managing the fish, the stock ponds? Do you notice at certain times of a month, connected to the moon or otherwise, they become more active, or is it just purely water temperature and weather and conditions, or air pressure?
I'm gonna give you as good an answer as I can and sit on the fence a little bit. I have a lot of friends that do a lot more carp fishing now than I do, and they are absolutely 100% on moon phases, and they're completely into it. And people say to me, oh, do you fish on the moon? And I say, when I get the chance to go fishing, I go whatever. So it could be the worst moon or the best moon. If I get a chance to go, I'll just go. If I worried about the moon, I would probably never go. So I think there is definitely, there is stuff to it. And I remember as a student many, many years ago, it being discussed. Guys that I was learning a lot from then were telling me that moon phases affect fish's feeding. So I'm absolutely sure it does play a part. And if you've got time and you can pick when you go in the month, then maybe you should look at the moon phases. I don't get those options, so I go when I get a chance. In terms of the farm, I think I'll be totally honest, I've not really thought about the fish feeding on the farm from a moon perspective, but the weather plays a colossal part in their feeding, definitely. And tied up with that, oxygen is the massive, massive driver, which as a fish farmer, you're just in tune with all the time.
Yeah, that was great. Part two next week.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, he's superb. It was such a long chat, and we could have gone on longer. And spoiler alert, at the end, he did say he would come back for even more questions. So we'll maybe do some more listeners' questions for him next time. But yeah, check out part two next week. Fantastic interview. Something we haven't done for ages, Mark.
I'll tell you what I haven't done for ages.
What?
Driven at 40 through a 30 with a police van sat there waiting to take my picture.
Yeah, that's not advised.
Not since Tuesday, anyway. That's really, really what's on my mind and annoying me right now, because I'm in that limbo at the minute. Did he get me? Didn't he get me? Am I going to have a pink form to fill in?
In my experience, they've got 2 weeks to send them, but they normally come fairly soon. You're normally gone within the week, so...
Yeah, I need some new toilet roll anyway.
Sometimes they're just the tax fans, aren't they? They're checking for, like, insurance and stuff like that. But, yeah, they've probably copped your speeding. I would have thought my last one was 36 in a 30, and, like, 100 yards before the 50 sign.
This was, you know, where the 60... goes for a little village that's a 30, and he was about another, not even 100 yards in there. So I was already slowing down anyway, but I should have slowed down a bit more. Maybe not, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Although I do remember once I did actually get caught, this one. But I like to send a letter, write him a nice polite letter back and try and argue with him. It never works, but I just like to do it, waste the time. But I remember I didn't this time. Because I was thinking, if you look at pictures, they'll see I was on the phone, so I best not.
No, you just bubbled yourself up. Yeah, not good. Get yourself a hands-free kit. Yeah, cool. Carp ain't sheep.
Carp are not sheep.
We haven't done one of these for a little while, but something worthy of mentioning. the retainer shots in the water. That though, it's this has come about from the nice retainer slings, which are a great invention. I think they move on from carp sacks. They're safer for the carp. Floating retainers, you can just and use it for weighing the carp as well, and you just bang them in when you catch a fish in the early hours or whatever. Wait till it's light enough to take a picture, and then away you go.
They're safer than sacks if they're used correctly, and the fish is not in there for more than 15-20 minutes when you get them sorted. But you see one shot, you've seen them all. I don't want to see the sling, I want to see what's in it.
I saw job. This is something I've just remembered, actually. It's on the net.
It's on the net, it must be true.
Johnny Mack has made a number of posts. He's posted a number of night shots, really well lit night shots.
Yeah, I saw this.
He's making a point. There's a situation happened on Stone Acres, I think, with the guys alleged to have had a fish in the sack for an extremely long time overnight, and then took pictures in the morning. Things caught it early in the night. Apparently, the fish is supposed to be in there 10 hours or something, which you shouldn't do. Anybody who's maybe a bit younger or a bit more inexperienced, you know, you should not have a carp in a retainer for any more than a couple of hours.
I'd say 1 hour's too long.
No, I have done it. If I catch a fish at four o'clock in the morning and it's light at six, you know, I'm going to retain it. You shouldn't do it in the summer when, you know, especially in shallow water when the oxygen's lower as well. But you shouldn't ever sack fish in shallow water, in shallow warm water. It's a bit safer this time of year when it's the water's cooler. But as Simon said, there isn't always more oxygen in cooler water, depending on the weed growth and stuff in the water. But as a rule, you shouldn't. And cameras are so good nowadays, there's no need to. I mean, do you remember when I cut the twin? Was it 12 years ago? You know, I used to get a car. If you were near the road or the car park, car headlights. Yeah, we used to illuminate the scene basically. So I mean, we used to wear red tops as well, didn't we? I think Julian Condiff used to wear the red top, as did you. You used to take a red top fishing.
Yeah.
Anything that will stand out in the dark. So it's good to be in front of a bush or something with background and then illuminate it. I mean, I've done it with head torches. I've had two or three head torches, like kind of pointing, not at the fish, but at the background around the fish, you know, like the tree that's behind you or the bush or whatever. Just stuff to illuminate the background, and then a normal camera flash will do the job.
Both our PBs are the same fish, the fat lady, and we both have night shots of her.
Yep, I caught the. This is a prime example. I caught my PB, which was £58, was it, or something? Was it 58? I caught it, or 56?
Yes, you had it at 58 because I had it exactly 3 months earlier at 46.
Yeah, that's right.
Spawned out.
Yeah, well, that's something else Simon Scott talks about with female fish in the interview is losing. Some can lose 20% of their body weight, and he reckons all fish. Female fish lose and put on a hell of a lot. I caught it at 9 p.m. on a November night, 1st of November it was. Now obviously 9 p.m. there's no way I was sacking a fish, any fish, let alone a fish of that size, until what, 6:37 a.m. the following morning. That just wasn't going to do it. And, you know, it was my PB, it was the fish that I was there to catch, and the night shots, they're great, they're perfectly fine. And even if they weren't, it doesn't matter. I still would not keep that fish till morning. And at this time of year, I mean, a very common bite time in the autumn going into the winter is just after dark. It's an extremely common bite time. You've just got to take the pictures. You've just got to do it. I had single scale out of Yateley just after dark in December. Again, same thing. I mean, there's no sacking allowed on there anyway. And it was obviously pre-retainer slings, but, you know, you just have to do the pictures. And you shouldn't be keeping fish more than a couple of hours. And I think Johnny Mack was making a point very clearly there by posting a load of his night shots that were all really good shots. I've had two front covers of Carp Talk with fish with night shots. And, for a shot to get on the front cover, it's got to be a very clear, decent shot. Otherwise, they just don't do it. And I've had two night shots on the front cover.
Yeah, so. I'd also like to say, if people are in any doubt of their photographic capabilities in the dark, just next time you go for night fishing, just practice.
Just practice. But I mean, you try and illuminate the area. You can do it with head torches or car headlights if you can get a car near to it. And make sure you're in front of something. Never do it in front of the water because it just looks black behind. You can just see literally your face and the fish. And do it in front of some sort of background, usually a bush or whatever, a tree, or, you know, just get something behind you that can be illuminated by the flash, and the picture's fine.
This has made me think of one thing. We need to get someone like Ollie Davis on as a guest. He's a wizard with a camera. He'll be able to answer all these questions a lot better than we can.
Yes, we're doing a little Christmas gift project with Ollie. I'm not going to tell you exactly what it is just yet, but one of the things we're working on does involve Ollie's fantastic photography. So yeah, more news on that in a few weeks. But back to the car paint sheep. Don't retain your fish for loads of hours, and don't take pictures of the retainer sling in the water because it makes me jealous because I'm not fishing and I've not caught any fish. But I just see it. It's the customary shot now, isn't it? The a rod missing and a retainer sling floating in the water.
Do you know what I'm going to do now before this car cast is publicised and released? I'm going to go through my Facebook and delete any retainer shots that I've put on myself just so I don't look like a tit.
I've never had one. I've got on the older retainers, it doesn't zip up as well, so if I did leave it in there for an hour or two, there's a good chance the fish won't be in there. And get it out, it's probably gone. But we're introducing the on the bank feature. Hopefully we'll have a good one with Ian McMillan on Euro Aqua. But right now we have our friend of the show, Roger Bacon. On the bank.
So man on the bank is Roger Bacon, somebody we spoke about loads in the show. He's actually on the bank in France right now. You've just had a fish, haven't you?
Yeah, just managed to get sorted, get back in me bivvy. It's raining at the minute, but yeah, just had my fifth fish. And surprisingly enough, it's bloody my fifth biggest fish ever. Been here since last still over Friday. Been here since started, been fishing since Saturday. Had five fish. I've had, I don't know, bloody smallest have been 45, 48, 49, and 253 commons. So, oh my God!
Wow! So yeah. How big's the one you've just had?
Well, I've just had is 45-12. Funny thing was, I had two of my three fishing rods out of the water. I was re-chucking at the time, probably 10 minutes later, and that rod that I had the fish on would have been wound in. So, a bit lucky there.
I spoke to you yesterday. You just moved peg, hadn't you? Was it like new spots that you've just caught off?
Well, that one was first three fish that I had. Like I told you yesterday, I was fishing opposite. Fishing three quarters of the way across the lake to an area that I'd done me three bites, and then yesterday daytime I see a fish showing the margins of the peg opposite that I was casting at, so I thought, you know, pop down there, I can fish a quarter of the way across the lake to the same areas that I've done bites, and took one down the edge to the right, and yeah, it's paid off. I've had a fish off that. Happy days.
It's a pretty decent average as well. You've had what, 250s and all the rest have been 40s.
Yeah, 250s, all the rest have been 45 plus.
And
all five fish.
What's the lake?
All five fish. The lake where I am, it's I'm not that familiar with waters in France. The lads Wayne and the lads that I'm with, they've been here quite a few times. A lake called Saucy. Obviously, anyone will know it as the lake that used to have the world record common that you used to have in that died.
I thought it was, yeah. Was it like £100 or something?
Yeah. Big old common, £100. Obviously, the lake was booked up for years to come while that fish was in here, but unfortunately it passed away, and the lake's been a lot quieter since, so I had to jump on the trip with Wayne and the boys.
Wow. It's been a pretty decent session. How long have you got left?
Well, I've got two more nights left. Been quite confident actually. It was quite sunny yesterday. Daytime sort of didn't look right for a bite during the day, so we went for a little bit of a drive around the local area, went to the supermarket, got a few supplies, and we knew it was going to be wet and overcast for our last sort of 2 days, so you know, looking good for a bite now for the next couple of days. So yeah, a bit of luck, another lump will come along.
Well, thank you for being our first on the bank, and we hope you catch some more big ones before you get home.
Well, no doubt, Jamie. Fingers crossed. I'll give you the bell straight away if anything happens, and hopefully you'll hear from me in the next hour.
On the bank. Yeah, it makes me jealous again, being at peace, people out there fishing, and especially the fish that he's caught. His smallest fish is adds 43, which ain't bad, I don't think.
No, it's not bad at all. That's cracking. So even for France, that's...
It's a cracking session, yeah. I mean, the smallest fish 43, biggest 50-odd. Very, very nice. Very nice. Yeah. And but maybe we'll get out. We could do a carp cast social on that source as well at some point.
Yeah, we could do. But I've got to ask, you know, because you've spoke to Simon Scott, you interviewed Adam Penning, you know, the Mark Holmes one, and after each one of those, you've said you're just itching to get out fishing after, especially the Adam Penny one where he caught at the end of it.
Yeah.
When are you getting the rods out?
Yeah, things are conspiring against me at the minute, just time-wise. I can only really see me doing a couple of nights on a day ticket late. I know we're going to do some of the interviews on one of the southern lakes, maybe Raisbury or one of the Oxford lakes. I'm going to be doing that over the next few weeks.
So. I certainly want to get out and do more interviewing and chatting on the bank. I mean, it's good enough on, you know, using the Skype and that, but there's something better being on the bank, being out there, being just doing it.
Yeah, blanking, you mean?
Well, let's go down and fish with Adam Penn and he catches.
Yeah, we need to go with people that can teach us. But yeah, I'm going to be out soon. We can do our own on the bank or Mark's Carp Diaries. I think, but yeah, I mean, it's been a long show, this one. We've got part two of Simon Scott next week, so tune in for that. It should be every week now, so you don't have to wait as long to get your fix. And once again, we'd like to say a big thank you to DNA Baits, www.dnabaits.com. Use the discount code CARPCAST5 when you check out, and there's a 5% discount on anything you get, or you can actually take the Evo Cured Hook Baits offer. Take the hook bait kit for £20 delivered, which is a special carp cast offer. Or don't forget their £120 20 key post free boilie deal as well that they're doing there, so you can stock your freezer for this busy autumn period. DNABaits.com. And of course, Hobo Armour.
Yes, Hobo Armour. www.hoboarmour.co.uk. Yep. Give them a look. There's some cracking clothing on there, some nice witty t-shirts, any size you want, they've got them. Yeah, the same, what's it, the same CarpCast 5 as you're checking out for the 10% discount.
Yeah, it's hoboarmour.com, hobo, H-O-B-O armour, A-R-M-O-U-R.com.
.com, not .co.uk.
It's .com. .co.uk probably works as well, but it's the site I'm on currently is hoboarmour.com. CarpCast5 as a discount code. So, until next week. That's nice saying that, isn't it? Until
next week.
Yeah, we'll see you then.
See you next time.